You to stand and join in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please call the roll.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer?
Here.
Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
We have minutes from the regular council meeting of October 5th, 2015 and October 19th, 2015. Are there any corrections? If not, may I have a motion and a second for approval of both sets of minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. For the agenda, we need to move R-17515 from the consent agenda to new business because an amendment sheet is required. Are there any other requests? If not, may I have a motion and a second for approval of the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Welcome. We offer several opportunities during the meeting for public comment. During the public hearings, old business, new business. At the end of the meeting, there is an open comment section where any individual is entitled to speak for 3 minutes about anything. Each individual is entitled to 3 minutes. If you are a direct principal of an issue, you may ask for and receive 5 minutes. Those who have contacted the city manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak at the beginning of the meeting on any topic not on the agenda. Only 3 people can speak on the same topic. Tonight we have three requests, I believe. I will yield. Now let me point out that the council does not discuss these issues at the time the speakers come to the podium, but we may very well likely may discuss some of these issues at the end of the meeting during open council comment section. So I will yield 5 minutes to Angela Speck.
Thank you. How do I make it protect on that?
It was up there before.
We'll get it back for you.
Okay, I would like to talk to you about an event that's coming. In 658 days, on August 21st, 2017, there will be a total solar eclipse that comes across the U.S., and Colombia will be in the middle of that. We need to be ready for it. Just to put this in perspective, the last time there was a total solar eclipse on the continental U.S. was 1979. These maps show you all of the eclipses that happened between 2010 and 2050. You have to be under one of those paths to see it. The last one that came across the continental U.S. was in 1918. The last one that crossed Missouri was more than 2 centuries ago. This is an opportunity for people from Missouri, from the whole country, to see a total eclipse, and probably the only chance in their lifetime. I want to make this clear. This is when the moon comes between the Earth and the Sun. They happen approximately every 6 months. They're not always total, and the chances of them happening in one particular spot is very rare. So this is something that really doesn't happen very often. Okay, so what I'm showing here is this is an animation of what will happen. The shadow you can see there is the shadow of the moon, but it's only part of the sun that's missing. Until you can see a black spot, there's the black spot. If you are under the black spot, you see a total solar eclipse. So it hits Oregon, goes over Idaho, into Wyoming, into Nebraska, and then it comes over Missouri, and we are very close to the middle of the line, and then it goes on over Tennessee and off into South Carolina and off across the ocean. If you are not under that black spot, you do not see a total solar eclipse. This is just a simple close-up of the same idea, where the yellow line is where you have to be to see a total eclipse. The contours show you where you have the longest duration. You can see that we're very close to the longest duration. It's actually in the longest duration is actually in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. They get 2 minutes and 42 seconds of darkness. We get 2 minutes and 36. This one is a close-up on Missouri, and again, the contours show you how long. The closer to the edge you are, the shorter time you get. We're really close to the center of the line. You can also see that it goes over part of Kansas City, part of St. Louis. It actually extends from Oregon all the way to South Carolina. But we are in a prime location. Lots of people are going to be coming here to see this event. Now, this is just an image of what we're going to see. The whole event takes from the moon moving and taking a tiny bite out of the sun to being completely off the sun at the other side takes about 2 hours, with 2.5 minutes of darkness in the middle. This event is coming whether we want it to or not. And people will come here whether we want them to or not. Based on the sort of travel that happens due to eclipses, based on where we think people will travel to, and that there are 150 million people live within 8 hours of the path of the eclipse, we are predicting that there will be 400,000 people visit Columbia. We don't have the hotel rooms. We're not ready for that. Even if we do nothing, people are going to come, and we need to be ready. It's in the middle of the day. It's in August. We're going to have people ready to deal with traffic, to deal with emergencies, to deal with the food. If we do this right, we can actually make a lot out of this. We will come out looking fantastic and bring a lot of money into the city. But they're going to come whether we want them to or not. So I really want to urge the City Council to form a task force of the people that need to be involved with this, which would be, you know, emergency services, Chamber of Commerce, Tourism Bureau, all of those people, so that we can be ready for this and really make the most of it. Thank you.
Excellent presentation, Ms. Speck. I will yield 5 minutes to Lynn Maloney.
Hello, my name is Lynn Maloney. I'm with the group Race Matters. In a meeting on October 23rd, the police department's new community outreach unit described their work as redoing the department's community policing effort of the 1990s. They also described their goals as being directed by the recommendations from the mayor's task force on community violence. It is not possible for a unit whose mission is being carried out by only two officers to meet the task force recommendations. Those recommendations were for department-wide initiatives. The task force recommendations related to the department include aggressively addressing the trust gap between the African-American community and police and moving toward a community policing model. 2, cultural competency training for all officers. 3, moving beyond responsive policing and positively engaging the community. 4, to attract and train officers through professional development that rewards the skills of relationship building, community involvement, and cultural competency. And 5, to incentivize officers to live in the neighborhoods where they serve. So what is community policing? The officers describe their work as community policing. It is used in the task force recommendations, and the Columbia Police Department is described in the Citizen's Handbook as doing community policing already. Community policing is outlined in the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. The report asserts community policing must be a way of doing business by an entire police force, not just a specialized unit of that force. Community policing is also defined as a philosophy that promotes organizational strategies that support the systematic use of partnerships and problem-solving techniques to proactively address the immediate conditions that give rise to public safety issues such as crime, social disorder, and fear of crime. The DOJ's Community-Oriented Police Services explains that community policing is built on 3 pillars. 1, community partnerships. 2, problem solving. And 3, organizational transformation. On August 20th, the Columbia Police Department participated in a training by the Department of Justice's Community-Oriented Policing Services. The training focused on the need for procedural justice within a department before officers can be expected to engage procedural justice on the street. The focus of the day-long training was on organizational leadership, building a mission and vision statement, recruiting service-oriented officers, and the training of these officers. In other words, organizational commitment is required for community policing to work. The officers of the community outreach unit shared that they are accused by other officers of being social workers with a gun. This statement reflects that the Columbia Police Department has not yet fulfilled the third pillar of community policing, organizational transformation. And why was community policing abandoned in the 1990s? Could it be that a lack of organizational transformation and internal procedural justice were a part of that failure? And how is the current effort different? It is clear that the community outreach unit is staffed by dedicated and hardworking officers. Their efforts are commendable and are in alignment with the task force's vision of what is possible for the entire police department. It's also clear that the community outreach unit is not the equivalent to community policing, nor is it a satisfactory answer to the recommendations of the task force. We are asking for fulfillment of the task force recommendation for community policing. This is in conformance to current best practices of policing. It is in support of the best intentions of the best officers of our department. It will be a lot of hard work for all of us. The President's task force asserts that without procedural justice, quote, police intervention can't easily devolve into racial profiling, excessive use of force, and other practices which disregard civil rights, causing negative reactions from people living in already challenged communities. I believe we can all agree that our children deserve to be free from excessive force and violation of civil rights. They deserve so much more than that. Community policing, the report goes on to say, not only improves public safety, but also enhances social connectivity and economic strength, which increases community resilience to crime. It's also been noted to improve job satisfaction for line officers. Our community deserves and needs best practices for policing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maloney. I'll yield 5 minutes to Tracy Wilson-Kleekamp.
Good evening, Tracy Wilson-Kleekamp, that pesky lady from the Fifth Ward. I'm here with Race Matters. We've had a busy couple of weeks. We saw a presentation from Karen Oresti from the St. Louis Anti-Defamation League. We saw a presentation from some of our police officers on their community outreach unit. And we also had a meeting, which was confusing to me, about the status of some of the recommendations from the Mayor's Task Force on Community Violence. I've been thinking about this quite a bit, and I feel like we are having sort of a miscommunication about community policing. I'm not sure we all have the same definition or the same expectations, and that's one of the things that Race Matters is interested in, is that we come to a mutual agreement on what is community policing. I think it's a philosophy about how you treat people. There's some talk about police staffing, and I know that's part of it. My other concern is about how we fund the police, and I think they should have a dedicated revenue stream that looks like how we plan infrastructure. In other words, police are infrastructure to me. The other thing that kind of left me a little unsettled about the meeting last week about the recommendations was I didn't like the document. I'm a Virgo. I like the pages numbered, and I like things easy to read. And it didn't make sense to me. But you do have a document online that tells us exactly how much money you spend on social services, and that's important. I think what people were looking for is how well are we doing with the dollars that we spend. What are the obstacles? What are the challenges to making those dollars work? We know from the Public Policy Institute here at MU that we have issues with continuity. We have issues where minorities have the worst outcomes overall on everything, and that's a challenge. So I think we have a miscommunication about what we want in terms of community policing. I am not sure that we're getting everybody to the table when we have these conversations either. So I noticed, I would hope that when we have these meetings, we make sure everyone is at the table, Black church, the leaders, the homeschool communicators. I didn't see a lot of those folks there last week. I don't know if they weren't invited or if they were. I think it's really important that who's ever in charge of making sure that this transformation takes place, gets out and circulates in the community. We can't expect people who are most impacted by poverty and crime, et cetera, always to come to you. The last thing is I was gonna say that I think it's important that we keep adding things to our personal toolbox And I was interested in how we evaluate agencies and what they do with their dollars. The Public Policy Institute at Mizzou does some really cool stuff. But I would be interested in looking more deeply at each one of these agencies and what are their challenges in terms of funding, but what are their barriers to success, and how do we get those groups to interact more integrally with each other? We have a lot of redundancy. There's a lack of communication. And if we don't invest in this kind of spending and this kind of work at this level, that's where our kids end up having violence issues. So we got to do work on the front end and the back end. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll move to the public hearings. Please read item A.
Agenda item A is the construction of sanitary sewer improvements along Providence Road from 125 feet south of Stewart Road to Turner Avenue and along Turner Avenue to 4th Street, more specifically described as the Flat Branch Watershed Relief Sewer Project Number 2.
Staff.
This project will construct approximately 650 feet of 18-inch gravity sewer line. This line will connect to and replace an existing 8-inch line at the corner of 4th Street and Turner Avenue. This line will run down Turner to Providence and then north on Providence to a connection with Flat Branch Relief Sewer Number 1, as shown on this map. As a result of this project, two 18-inch existing lines crossing Providence at Turner Road Avenue will also be decommissioned as part of this project. In July 2014, funds were appropriated for both Flat Branch Sewer projects, and on August 4th, 2015, an interested parties meeting was held for this project. The estimated cost for this project is $410,000 and will be paid for from utility funds and jointly developer contributions. And with that, I'd like to answer any questions we can about this project.
Any questions, Council? Seeing none, let's open the public hearing. Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, any discussion by council? May I have a motion directing staff to proceed with plans and specifications for the Flat Branch Watershed Relief Sewer Project Number 2?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Please read item B.
Agenda item B is the construction of sidewalks on the east and south sides of Green Meadows Circle north of the Fire Station Number 7 entrance to Greenbrier Drive and stormwater improvements at the corner of Green Meadows Road and Green Meadows Circle.
Staff, please.
Thank you. Green Meadows Circles is a residential street located off Green Meadows Road. The proposed sidewalk project consists of construction approximately 360 feet of 5-foot sidewalk on the east and south sides of Green Meadows Circle, with approximately 8 feet of green space between the sidewalk and the curb. A small portion of the existing asphalt pavement at the corner of the intersection will also be replaced to take care of some storm drainage issues. The project cost is estimated about $75,000 and will be funded from a capital improvement sales tax. Construction is expected to begin this fall. Be happy to answer any questions.
Council?
Does this connect to two sidewalks?
Yes.
Okay.
There was a gap there when the fire station was.
Okay. Thank you.
And I take it this was on the CIP plan that was recently, that was a public referendum?
The prior one, the 05 ballot.
The 05 allocation.
I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Tracy Wilson, Klee Camp. This is my neighborhood. I'm sure all my neighbors are dancing a jig of happiness right now. They have wanted this for at least almost 10 years, and we have bothered poor Mrs. Nauser endlessly for it, so we're very happy about it. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? Close the public hearing. Council comments.
Well, I will, since this is my ward, and this has been a topic of conversation at many community meetings, and this just goes to show that city government does not work quickly.
But it does work.
It does work, yes. Yeah. Eventually it does. But I would like to make a point that this is city-owned property, and I think we should follow our own rules that we expect everyone else to. So when we require developers and property owners to put in sidewalks, that we should do so on our own property. So I'm glad that we're here today, and this is supposed to be done in the next couple of months. So I think this will be a great addition, especially for the poor people who have the water buildup at the end of their driveway. This will be a much easier winter for them. They won't have to put on their ice skates to get up their driveway. So thank you, and I will certainly vote yes on this.
Just a comment. This is kind of fun for me because Ms. Wilson-Kleekamp and I were on a group called Tariff that in 2005 opposed the city. We were activists at that time, my Footloose and Francie Free days. And when we opposed the CIP plan for different reasons, we thought that it was legitimate to ask for some of these requests, but that they didn't think about this. They didn't ask the right people to sit down to the table to negotiate what these priorities were. Some things never change. But I am glad that that some of these things were forwarded, are in line for improvements, and that we eventually got to them nonetheless. So I'm perfectly happy to support this kind of thing in Ms. Nauser's ward.
I support the project as well, and thanks Laura and Tracy for keeping working on this. I think the fact that it's taken 10 years suggests that we have inadequate funding sources for sidewalks, because I get lots and lots of calls about sidewalk gaps and missing sidewalks on busy streets that children and adults are walking on.
May I have a motion directing staff to proceed with plans and specifications for the sidewalk at stormwater improvements on the east and south sides of Green Meadows Circle?
So moved.
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Please read item C and B307-15.
Agenda item C is replacing existing light fixtures in the natatorium, gymnasium, hallway, maintenance room, and exterior areas of the activity and recreation center arc with energy efficient LED lighting. Council Bill 307-15 is an ordinance determining it is in the public interest to replace existing light fixtures in the natatorium, gymnasium, hallway, maintenance room, and exterior areas of the Activity and Recreation Center ARC with energy-efficient LED lighting, approving and adopting plans and specifications, determining that the work shall be done by contract, calling for bids through the Purchasing Division, determining that a portion of the project shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, authorizing the city manager to obtain, execute, and record all documents necessary for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law and state-mandated construction safety training, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mayor. This project is an $89,050 project to improve the lights at the ARC. Specifically, we'll replace the lights in the natatorium, gym, and hallways and other areas with energy-efficient LED fixtures and bulb. The lighting improvements include a mixture of replacing the fixtures, retrofitting some of the fixtures, and simple bulb replacements. Once the project is completed, we'll be eligible to apply for $12,000 in rebates from the Columbia Water and Light Department's lighting incentive programs, which if we get those funds will be put back into the programs. We estimate that this project will save us approximately $24,000 a year in our electric bill at the ARC. And the best news is this is funded from our FY 2014 surplus funds that were allocated back to us from our department savings. And I also like to thank Columbia Water and Light Department's Frank Cunningham. He was tremendous in helping us work out this and helped us with all the analysis with the fixture selection and everything else. We couldn't have done it without him.
Questions from council?
Yes. How long do you expect to receive these savings? And I can't remember what the life expectancy is of LED lights, so maybe this is going to be 10 years worth of savings or with the installation of these lights?
I think Frank estimated that we should start to see, once it's all done, once we get them all replaced, we should start seeing $24,000 a year in reduction.
Or, like I say, when I've bought LED lights to replace the ones, you know, the incandescent lights in my home, you know, I think it says, you know, 15 years of savings if you use it for so many hours.
Oh, right.
So what is the projected time frame of our savings? Is it going to be 5 years worth of savings to where we have to replace these is what I guess I'm getting
at. Oh, I don't know that. That's a good question. I'm not sure of that answer.
Okay. Because $24,000 is a good amount of numbers.
That's all I saw.
But is it going to be 10 years worth of $24,000 in savings, or is it going to be just, you know, 24 and then a diminishing return?
Correct.
What's a natatorium?
That is the pool.
Excellent.
Right, and that's the one we're going to contract out because we need somebody with some specific lift to get up there and get that one. So we'll do the rest, but we'll let somebody else do that.
Am I correct in assuming that the lifespan of some of the LEDs is really dependent on the number of times you turn them on and off?
I mean, right.
During the lifespan of these LEDs, right?
Correct. And with a lot of our priority bulbs, our fixtures are the ones that we leave on all the time. Those security lights that have to be on due to building codes that are 24/7.
Mike, I think these kind of efficiency savings can usually be characterized by there's a sort of an installation cost up front to change them over, but then there's the annual savings in electricity each year. And forgive me if this was in the report and I didn't spot it, but what's the installation cost up front?
Well, it is this whole $89,000. That's what we're paying.
$89,000, and then we save $24,000 a year
once it's done.
So
right.
We can think of a payback time of a little less than four years. Mm-hmm. After which we continue to make savings every year.
And I'll just underscore, I love everything about this personally because of the good fiscal management and fundamental management of the Parks Department, we saved a lot of money in the budget last year. That savings got split. And so half of it went to the council to put into the fund reserves or do other projects, which we did in the budget. The other half stayed in parks. They've used their half to pay it forward. They're permanently reducing their energy needs with this project. And so it's they haven't borrowed the money, and it's not been money we've had to figure out how to get it out of the budget. It's almost found because they didn't spend it last year. So that expense will have immediate cost reductions for them as we move forward. It's not a loan they have to pay back. So it's just a beautiful financial arrangement all the way around.
But it's also the potential for future savings in terms of the department not spending as much and having more in reserve.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public? Go ahead.
Sorry. I just have a question. It says the project's also eligible for $11,000 in rebates from the Columbia Water and Light Department's lighting incentive program.
Correct.
What is that?
It is a program offered by Water and Light. I think they left about all the details, but it's something we'll apply for and see if we can, you know, get those rebates. And if we get them, then we'll put them back into we'll further enhance our lighting replacement plan.
If you buy specific products, Water and Light will pay for part of the cost of them to rebate it to you. So you have to actually install them, and then we treat it as a rebate on the bill usually.
So it's like an internal transfer of funds.
We'll do this for any customer.
Exactly.
Yeah. So okay. Solar panels is an example where there are rebates for these products. These are mostly the LED lights, I believe.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Are any other questions? I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, we'll move to council discussion.
I have comments. I think it's great that we're moving forward and taking some one-time funds and using them for maximum benefit. But as we look at energy efficiency, if you cherry pick out the ones with the highest rate of return, it almost guarantees that we'll never invest in the ones that have a longer rate of return. And when we're able to do it systematically, it was a little bit like what Gary Ward said about focusing their maintenance dollars so that they get a fuller enhancement and improve the learning environment. If we can put together our energy efficiency savings in a package, then the ones with a four-year return, which is really good for energy efficiency, can help defray the costs of some of the ones that have a longer rate of return, and as a package overall, it makes financial sense to invest in those. So I don't fault this particular process because it was an opportunistic move to take advantage of some one-time funds in a very effective way. But in general, as we look to do energy efficiency in a systematic and organized way, we should really put together packages of energy efficiency projects that have varying rates of payback so that we can fund those ones and we can get a greater all energy efficiency savings.
Let me just comment that. I mean, I tend to agree with what you're suggesting and the direction that you're going, but I kind of look at this as low-hanging fruit and something to take advantage of. But we do have a pretty robust emphasis on renewables and so on, and in terms of energy usage. And we have a very capable person in Barbara Buffalo that has been looking for saving and has found tremendous savings in terms of commercial relighting and lots of other things. This is another one of those examples, not as much as commercial, but in terms of some of the city's assets for relamping, I think is the correct term, some of this and savings. And I'm not sure that it really discourages a comprehensive look at this, because I think there is a commitment on behalf of the city to really look at energy savings as a package. I mean, we're always concerned about balancing the budget, and one of the ways of doing that is finding efficiencies. There are other factors, but that certainly is something that we need to have continued emphasis on, and I think this fits into that program as well.
I'll make a couple of comments. First of all, I think citizens should expect their government to act like this, that we should act in a fiscally frugal and responsible manner. So the fact that these savings were identified and that you're going to achieve, you're going to pay for this in 3.5 years, that's a pretty robust investment, makes sense. And I don't think we should be patting ourselves on the back for that. I think it's something that I think we all should be expected to do throughout the whole city, but nonetheless, you've done it. As a minority opinion here, this is eligible for $11,000 in rebates of taxpayer money from my water and light bill and your water and light bill, which in my view is unnecessary. This is a project which pays for itself in 3.5 years. It's unnecessary to take revenue from the utility, which is the most expensive in the state of Missouri, to pay down this even further. And it just gets down to my skepticism about the wide array of rebates and incentives that are offered at the Water and Light Department. And this, for me, is an example. One is just not necessary. And, you know, I could cite anecdotes of others that are not necessary, too. And I just believe that at some point, it won't happen while I'm in office, but at some point this needs to be reviewed at a higher level by the Water and Light Department, the advisory board, and the council as a whole.
The purpose, as I understand it, of the rebates is to encourage both private and public customers of the water and light system to move to a more efficient mode of living and operating, using less energy, so that as a whole, as the city as a whole, we don't have to be spending $100 million every year importing dirty energy from mostly coal plants. So that's a lot of money that flows out of our community every year. And this $11,000, it's an internal accounting maneuver, really, but it's just part of a program that is designed to influence the way people make their choices about energy. And so I think it's a very valid use of the taxpayer or the ratepayers' funds to create a more efficient city. And I support the bill as well.
Any other comments? Please call the roll on, I think it's 307-15, is that correct?
Yes. Council Bill 307-15, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowser?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read PR 136-15.
Council Bill 136-15 is a policy resolution establishing a revised policy relating to repair, maintenance, and restoration of brick-paved streets in the City of Columbia.
Staff?
This is an item that was tabled at your September meeting for a period of 2 months to enable the Disabilities Commission an opportunity to review the proposed amendments to an existing policy resolution that we have on brick streets. That has been done, and a communication has been provided to the council. The commission acknowledges that they reviewed and are familiar with the policy changes. They had no vote on the item or comment, but they do express their gratitude to the council and to the Historic Preservation Commission. Questions? I'll try to answer.
Council, any questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any discussion by council?
I'll just thank the rest of council for supporting my motion that we tabled this last time to allow the Disabilities Commission to check it out, and I think we've done a good process on that.
And just one comment about this. We've been discussing this for some period of time. It's been before the Historic Preservation Commission. It's been before P&Z and so on. We've got lots of reports, lots of inputs, lots of public input. Disabilities Commission has weighed in on this as well. Parenthetically, let me add that, you know, I recently attended a festival in Fulton, as a matter of fact, and it was all based around brick streets. I mean, they had a kind of a theme of brick streets, a very successful festival, as I understand it. So there is something, there is this historic preservation aspect to it, and I think this is a measured attempt at trying to preserve some of our history without going too far with digging up things and rebuilding streets and so on and so forth. I agree with my colleague that this has been a pretty good process. And I'm prepared to move forward with it. I appreciate the input of the staff and all of the boards and commissions that weighed in on this. I think it's significant, and I think it's something that we ought to endorse.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 136-15, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Read B-2295-15.
Council Bill 295-15 is an ordinance amending Chapter 20 of the City Code as it relates to the schedule of fees for processing rezoning applications from any district to District R1 and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff.
What this proposed ordinance does is really expressed in the title of the item as just read by the clerk. This would establish that no application fee would be required for individuals making application to change the zoning of their property from any district to R1, which is our most restrictive zoning district, one family dwelling. By way of background, we do have an old policy resolution. It dates from 1993, and that provides for a waiver of the fee and also the advertising expense for individuals that are making downzoning requests. That policy resolution that you can read in your packet had some terms and conditions. There's a requirement that those requests be made one of 2 months of the year, November and December. December and January of any given year, so I got that off by a month. As I mentioned, the cost of advertising was paid by the city as well. We do have in our regular fee schedule, we already have a couple of these small incentives. It's not shown in the excerpt of the ordinance, but any zoning from a county jurisdiction to an equivalent city zoning, there's no application fee charged currently in the ordinance. You can see here that there's some existing language that exempts an individual putting their property into the Historic Preservation Overlay District from a fee. So this is similar in nature to those items. Our concern is that we have two systems. We have an express fee schedule that's part of the city code, and then we have a very old policy resolution. We'd like to update it and just put it into the same code chapter that these policies are currently housed in. We've also become aware through the preparation of the West Central Area Neighborhood plan that there are a number of individuals interested in voluntarily downzoning their own properties, and so we are expecting a number of petitions. The staff have been getting a lot of inquiries. They're asking, what is your policy on fees? All we have to fall back on in that instance is the 1993 policy resolution. So we'd like to get this this done fairly soon.
Questions from council?
I just have a question. It was brought to my attention. There's a bit of a history of this in terms of several of us many years ago tried an attempt at downzoning what we called stale properties at the time, a few years ago. There were about a dozen properties. I think we were in Planning and Zoning Commission at the time. Brought to the attention of the City Council, it didn't fly. I mean, it didn't work. And it's very difficult to downzone properties because there is an inherent interest in the value of the property if it's upzoned. But I guess the question I have is have you considered or would you consider the possibility of entertaining some adjustment to this? So not only could you forgive the fees for the application, perhaps the advertising, I don't know, that depends on the discussion that the council has, but in order to not to downzone these properties, not only all the way to R1, but perhaps even to R2, which is kind of an interim step in some of these neighborhoods that might provide more of an incentive for people not to give up some of the value in the upzone property that they have, but yet encourage them to downzone the property such that it would be it conform more to the community standard, if you will. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, it's certainly up to the council to do that. If you regard that type of zoning change to be worth this incentive. And by the way, our base fee for rezoning is $300. So just to give you an idea what the figure is.
Yeah, regardless of what category you're
that's
changing
right.
the zoning.
That's right. A rezoning action will cost you a $300 application fee and then a $125 advertising fee. I would recommend that whatever you do, don't waive the advertising fee because that's an outside cost.
Okay.
So we've already accounted for the costs of the personnel that handle the applications, but could be burdensome if we have a large volume of downzoning cases and pay all that advertising.
Thank you for that.
Tim, can you talk about how this ordinance relates with elements of the comprehensive plan?
Well, it's viewed as something for neighborhood preservation. By that, I mean you're going to have some areas in the city, neighborhoods, maybe particular streets, where the zoning is mismatched with the actual use and the actual potential of the individual properties. By that, I mean, if we refer to this West Ash area, I don't want to get into an analysis of zoning before its time, but just to use as an illustration, you have lots that by the district they're in are either too small an area or too narrow to support a second dwelling unit.
Mm-hmm.
So they're useful for single family purposes anyway. So in the view of someone who is requesting one of these downzonings, they'd be preserving that character of the neighborhood. So I think that is consistent with the comprehensive plan in the sense that neighborhood preservation is very important. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. There's probably street corners and things where, from a planning perspective, we think that could support higher density, if anything. And, you know, there are areas that are better suited for development. But those areas where the lots are undersized and the district they're in basically says the only use that's available is single family, unless they're consolidated in larger packages and redeveloped. It makes some sense. There is an impact if one is an investor in property. You'll recall we have a definition of family that says four unrelated adults can live in a dwelling unit in R2. In R1, it's three. So there would be some impact that folks ought to be aware of if they're interested in using their property for that purpose.
Well, I'm also interested in the option to downzone from R3 to R2 as well as to R1. Also, this, as written, would be properties of that are zoned commercial would be eligible to downzone to R1 and waive the fee?
That's correct. We had a number of discussions in the office and decided to propose to you something that's simple in structure. So really any rezoning to R1, it is our most restrictive district, and that could mean that you get a large tract in which the existing conditions include a mix of districts and maybe a portion of it is zoned R1, so we'd leave that out of the fee calculation is what.
What would be your thoughts about modifying the ordinance to make it applicable only to currently residential zoned properties?
Yeah, I think that's something we could look at. Probably would want to look at this to advise council on whether we think there might be some instances where there's other districts where properties are actually used residentially that might want to take advantage of that.
Even though they may
program.
Be zoned commercial.
Yeah, possibly there's some of that, but otherwise certainly wouldn't raise an objection. It's your policy. So.
Well, these would be evaluated on a case-by-case basis anyway, regardless of whether they were commercial or residential or any other.
Yeah, to set a fee doesn't say we're in favor of the particular zoning change. It'll all be evaluated on their on their own merits through the Planning and Zoning Commission and Council process.
So, sorry, if this is passed as written, then there would the Planning and Zoning Commission would still decide whether or not to waive the fee on the case-by-case basis?
No. I believe we're talking about the merits,
the
merits of the rezoning would be evaluated.
The rezoning would have to be evaluated. Okay.
Does this include agricultural?
Yeah, currently the ordinance says any change from ag to district R1, that fee is waived. It doesn't include 2R1, but, or 2A1. Excuse
correct
me
if I'm wrong, but isn't a rezoning from agricultural to residential, that's an upzoning, really. It's more dense, isn't it?
Depends on how you look at it. Ag could include some commercial activity of an agriculture on a large enough
but generally site. Speaking, I mean...
Within the city limits, they tend to be very benign uses that you find in A1, but it can include commercial type agricultural functions.
Would it be worth
keeping of animals, et cetera?
Yeah. Would it be worth tabling this and looking at it from the R3 to R2 and the agricultural?
Yeah, and I think that's what we'd like to do is just look at what the impact of that change would be and report our comments to you. I think those are fine suggestions. We do have, as you're no doubt aware, in East Campus, there's a number of downzoning has been done over the years from R3 to R2 as well as to R1. So
with those considerations,
we know it's been done.
How much time would you like? I mean, if we were going to make...
I would think just a one meeting turnaround would be sufficient for that.
Well, I certainly will make the amendment to table this for the one meeting so that the staff can consider the discussion that we've had.
I support that, but do we need to have the public hearing first and then?
Yeah, well, it's probably a good idea. But it's good.
It's a good thing
for the public to know that we're considering an amendment.
Okay, why don't we do this? This is the public hearing, and you can then withhold your amendment until after public hearing.
Sure.
So I'll invite.
We can include that.
I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak?
Good evening. My name is Mary Ratliff. I reside at 211 Park DeVille Drive, and I would like to encourage the council to please table this because, you know, what you're dealing with, I don't totally understand all that is going on here, but what you're dealing with here affects people, property, residential areas, et cetera. So I would hope that you all would take a little time to look at this before you would pass it. So I would recommend that the council would table this tonight. And I don't know if 2 weeks is time enough for the staff to really research it, but I hope that you will table it.
Did a screen grab of it.
Anyone else?
Mark Farnan, 103 East Brandon, Columbia, Missouri. I want to throw something else in there to think about if you table this. I think that this bill seems fairly innocuous on its face, but I believe that the bill actually does more than what it says, or at least has the potential to, and I think that's kind of what's been discussed. Ostensibly, this eliminates the application fee for downzoning requests and allows those requests to be made at any time during the year. The staff notes in this report indicate that this is in keeping with the intent of a policy that was established in 1993 that provided that kind of fee relief as a protection for neighborhoods. Actually, this ordinance does more than just what it says. It's clear that in the original policy resolution, The relief and downzoning process was intended to be used by groups of homes, not single applicants. And comments by staff in the Columbia Tribune indicated that they hoped such applications would be submitted by groups, not single applicants. The rationale for that is clear. It takes a group of homes to make a neighborhood, not a single property. And the intent is to protect neighborhoods, not to insulate an isolated piece. Language in this bill, however, does not make that distinction and allows for individual, not group application. It also, in the discussion, talks about the nullification of the early ordinance, which ensconced that whole idea of neighborhood protection. Problem with the single applicant approach is that it does not promote neighborhoods. It could be used to inhibit the fair use of nearby properties, depending on what we do when we adopt a new zoning code. The new zoning code has some provisions in Module 3 that would allow somebody who has an R1 property to make an objection against an R3 property and make them reduce their footprint in the R3. And it gives an unfair advantage to the R1, or at least nullifies some of the available use for a property that's already zoned that way. The new code has not been adopted, I know that. The whole idea, though, of revamping that code was to make sure that all the little pieces fit together and that it was not piecemeal. Passage of this bill tonight kind of hijacks that process. It's not cooperative. It potentially establishes a rule that artificially favors the rights of one single property owner over another, and process-wise should not be considered until after the full zoning code is, so we know how this works in light of the passage of whatever it is we pass. One more question. If you downzone from an R3 to an R1 and you have a loan on that property based on an appraisal, does that mess with the loan that you have at the bank because you have intentionally diminished the value of the collateral? I don't know the answer to that. I'm asking. I think this proposal requires more thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question of the?
Sure.
You have an interesting perspective, and I appreciate your perspective from the point of view of the neighborhood interest and so on. Yeah. We really don't. I'm not sure we have a mechanism in which a neighborhood can make some of these decisions. It almost has to be based on a property-by-property kind of situation. I absolutely agree with you that we probably need to think about these things, and I think should this amendment pass that I will make, and maybe we need more than a couple of weeks, probably a month, to think about this, some of the questions that you've raised and some of the questions that have come up in terms of whether or not we do need to go down to R1 or R2 or so on, and in terms of where the recommendations are, but I thank you for your input here. And you see this obviously as a way to make sure that there is some equity between the property rights of the potential for developing some of these properties and the neighborhoods themselves and the individual properties.
That's right. And here's what we don't know. And that's why I brought up we're in the process of this whole zoning code revolution.
Yeah.
In there are some suggestions, and we don't know what's going to be passed. There are some suggestions that if, for instance, you have an R3 property and it may be zoned that way and an R1, the R1 as a protective mechanism would be able to reduce the footprint of what is built on that R3 property by reducing the height, the step down 15 sure. feet, 10 foot setback, sure. that sort of thing. It gives an unfair advantage to that person then who is an R1 over the R3. And if they intentionally do that on a piece by piece basis, it doesn't protect a neighborhood, it protects or insulates a single piece. And that would be an injustice to the rights of the other property.
That certainly is a perspective. It all depends on how we decide about what that equity is. And so
and what's a neighborhood.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
It takes a village.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Dan Cullimore, I live at 715 Lyon Street. I'm the president of the North Central Columbia Neighborhood Association. However, I'm not speaking on that in that position tonight. I certainly would encourage you to table this, and I agree that maybe 2 weeks is, it may not be enough. I certainly appreciate the questions that Mark Farnan has raised. I don't necessarily agree with the position that he takes with regard to the relative merits of R3 and R1 properties. I think that there's just as much of a chance for an R3 property currently to have detrimental consequences for an R1 use. And fundamentally, I think there's a real question with regard to the new development code about exactly what is the highest and best use for a property. So in some cases, it is the use that is currently being and at least in our neighborhood's condition of all of it being R3, but its use is R1, so that is for many of the property owners there, the homeowners who are residents, that's its highest and best use. But for somebody who's looking at it as an investment and for its speculative value, that's obviously not the case. So whose highest and best use takes precedent? Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
My name is John Clark of 403 North 9th Street, and like several people, I've thought long and hard about this. I'm glad you're taking this up. You should table it for at least a month, need to get more input. I think maybe people have said it needs to be mentioned it's residential down, not just any kind of down, probably R2 and R1 as opposed to this. There's a background to this that really feeds into the equity of this. According to Tim Teddy, he said, and I don't know what happened south of Broadway, but north of Broadway, Benton Stevens North Central and the areas going all the way out to the west, maybe to Clinkscales, were blanket upzone probably in 1969, probably about the time we annexed 20 square miles and so forth. If I understand that case, I'm certain the person who owned my house, which is built in 1913 as a single family housing, did not ask for that. They may not have objected, but they didn't ask for it. So this is not anything about, this was the city council doing it. And it may have been thought at the time that was great, and there would be no negative consequences and all this kind of stuff. I can tell you there were disastrous consequences. Basically, it said, we had a lot of old houses. So the vectors supporting investors, all this kind of stuff, made it hard for people to buy. We had a tremendous number of houses that were divided into 2, 3, 4, 5 apartments. Didn't have to do a thing with zoning because it's already been granted by the city council without really any input. A lot of those houses are gone because we also had disastrously low code compliance. We didn't have a rental compliance ordinance until 1979. So as a matter of equity, the right to downzone at no cost, or maybe a maximum of a $50 per parcel cost for a share of the advertising cost, is a matter of equity to balance out. And I believe, I've talked to Dan and so forth, the use value of my house is my use. That whole way of doing things basically is biased toward the idea of an investor. Well, that's a use of a property. But the use value for most of the people in my neighborhood and probably off to the west is in living there, in owning that, being their house, their forever house, and so forth. I'm sorry about limiting somebody next door, but given that blanket zoning that opened the door and greased the wheels to turn my neighborhood into a 75% absentee owner, landlord-owned desert, I think you need to basically keep this balance, follow along with this, keep low fees, and frankly, that will slow down some of the redevelopment. But if you allow this go up, following Mr. Farman's view, you're just basically greasing the rules for real rampant abuse. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll move to council discussion.
I just have one question, then I'm going to make an amendment. And it's a question of Mr. Teddy. And it has to do with, has this been, I didn't notice, maybe I missed it, has this been at all referred to the Planning and Zoning Commission for any kind of recommendation?
We didn't. It's not part of the zoning chapter. It's part of the Chapter 20, which is planning.
Right.
So you could certainly ask their comment. Again, this is just the cost of asking the permission that we're after.
Sure, but I'm after a different philosophical question.
Not what these zonings are going to look like, because it has to do
with the whole idea of downzoning and whether or not there ought to be an interim step and whether it's ought to be two categories and not just one and so on and so forth. I would love to have that kind of input in addition. But and along those lines, I certainly will make the amendment that we table this for actually 1 month and to the December, I guess it's a December 7th meeting, so that we can get that input, if that's possible, but also the input of the staff in terms of your best judgment and how this discussion might play out in terms of a decision the City Council would make.
We have a motion to table. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion on the motion to table? All in favor of the motion to table to the first meeting in December, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. We'll move to 30315. Please read the bill.
Council Bill 30315 is an ordinance appropriating funds for the Transit Service Analysis and Planning Assistance Project and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff.
At the March 16, 2015 council meeting, resolution R4915 was passed, authorizing the purchasing agent to request proposals for consulting services, a complete operations review, and market analysis of the Como Connect system. Seven proposals were received, and a selection committee comprised of staff from Public Works, Columbia Public Schools, the University's Director of Parking and Transportation, the members of the Public Transit Advisory Commission, and the Disabilities Commission evaluated the seven proposals and interviewed three firms. Based on presentation, interview, and qualifications, the selection committee chose Olson Associates as the preferred consultant, and purchasing has negotiated a contract-based cost of $161,406. Once the funds have been appropriated with this legislation, purchasing will finalize the contract with Olson Associates. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Council?
Just one question that it's, it's kind of hard to see that it's pretty small.
Yeah, that's.
But is anything in the scope of this request having anything to do with some of the ancillary ideas along with transit, that is bus shelters and so on? Has that question been asked, or is that?
Well, they're going to be doing a complete operational analysis of the system, so they'll be looking at everything.
That should include that.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And am I correct in saying that they will develop a long-term master planned and funding sustainability plan for the system?
Absolutely. Those are all included.
And is the proposal put to you by Olson Associates a public document that we can have access to and share so we can see what they proposed?
Well, it depends at what point in time, after it's been awarded, yes.
But right
well,
now?
Well, it's in negotiation stages, not necessarily.
But it sounds as though the fee's been agreed. Mm-hmm.
But the contract has not been
so
been
after the contract is signed, that can be released, and we can see what they proposed, and also their credentials for doing this work.
It may not be public release, but surely it could be released to the City Council.
I would imagine that there might be a way for you to be able to have access to
Well, actually,
council
I have
members,
seen it. John Glasscock sent it to me, but he told me that I couldn't pass it on to anybody else until a certain time. I'd like to be able to share it.
Well, I'd like a copy, too.
Oh, I can send it. Can I send it to him?
Through the city
Can I
clerk.
Ask who else they have, what other cities this company has
Yes, they've done quite a few. They've done Lawrence, Kansas, Ames, Iowa. I think they were in Wichita.
So a number of college.
Yeah, a number of other college towns. That's correct. Manhattan, Kansas as well. Yes.
And do we have some idea when they will actually have a report for us once we find? I realize we have to finalize the contract.
Sure. It would take the entire process for all deliverables would take 14 months, but there'll be staged phases along the way. So they'll do the complete operational analysis in the first, I think, 4 months. And then they'll be kind of releasing those reports as they go along through the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members, Mr. Mathis. I'm Cheryl Price, 511 Parkade Boulevard. I'm the current chair of the Public Transit Advisory Commission, or PTAC, as it's commonly known. And I am here tonight on behalf of the whole commission. Before I get started, the commission would like me to go on public record as thanking Councilman Thomas for getting us started rolling on this project, and now we don't know where it will lead us, but we think it will be nothing but good. And to also thank our wonderful staff, Drew Brooks and now Dave Nichols that works with him. All our drivers and our administrative staff are just unbelievable, everything they get done in the number of hours they have to do it. I was involved in the process from beginning to end as one of the members of the selection committee. I also helped in reviewing the scope of work and adding a few comments and changes to that. So I've been with this from beginning to end, and I am looking forward to really getting started with the consultant. Olson and Associates really presented an excellent proposal. Not only will they provide us with the short-term, mid-term, long-term evaluation of our system, but also with funding sustainability and help us with looking for other possibilities for funding, which we all know we really need to find if we're going to do what we want to with our transit system. The PTAC took a very strong position on that we wanted to be involved and thought we needed to be involved in this process from beginning to end. And like I said, we have been, and I was happy to see that all the proposals listened to that in the bid also. And everything that Olson and Associates has sent us includes the PTAC all along the way. So that was really good to see from them and from the other consultants. But Olson and Associates, I think you will find, will do an excellent job. And I really expected the bid to be higher than what it was, having dealt with grant writing and bids and proposals before. The PTAC does feel very strongly that whatever we developed, whatever we end up developing, we must have a true transit philosophy for Columbia, built around social equity, which I know that the council and city manager have built their last strategic plan around. We think that's extremely important, that people with low incomes, people that are visitors, people that are just citizens, regular riders, whatever, that everyone be involved in being able to use transit. I'd like to thank you very much for everything you've done to this point and urge you to vote yes for the appropriation, and we'll take it from there along with Drew and Dave. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? We'll move to council discussion. Any discussion by council? Seeing none?
I've got a comment. You want to go first, Carl?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I probably can't talk about the proposal, but you did say that they worked in Lawrence, and I think that's a very interesting model for us because, as we learned on one of the trips about 2 or 3 years ago to visit three other college towns with really good public transportation systems, Lawrence expanded its public transit system dramatically around about 2008, 2009 by simultaneously passing a citywide sales tax to improve transit for the community, and the students at the University of Kansas passing an activity fee to improve the student-oriented routes. And it's hard when we live in a town that has a deeply underfunded public transit system to understand what a great community amenity, a really good transit system where buses come every 15 to 20 minutes. They come close to where most people live and work and go to school and recreate, where they run late at night and they run 7 days a week. To understand what a great amenity that is, we don't have any of those things here because we have a very cash-starved system. And we end up spending a lot more money on building and maintaining roadways than we would if we put on a good system that people really would use. But I encourage everybody to pay attention if you're traveling to other towns. I just took a trip to Gainesville, Florida a couple of weeks ago, and they have an excellent transit system. And Lawrence, Ames, Champaign-Urbana, Iowa City are other examples in this part of the country, college communities like ours that have figured this out. So I'm very excited and congratulate the staff and the committee that read those seven long, long proposals and sorted through the credentials of the different applicants. Cities all over the country are improving their transit system, especially college towns. We need to jump on this bus, and I'm excited to see what happens over the next 14 months.
I just have a question and then maybe a comment, and that is, it's a good point, and the extent to which the university is involved in this consultant, in the consultant's purview, if you will, is the university being brought into this whole discussion as well? With
absolutely. They were involved in the selection process, I mean, and they'll be involved in the entire process.
Obviously, Ian has it quite right. I mean, most of the university communities, Boulder and Gainesville and all of these other places have adopted a model whereby this is kind of implicit in the student activity fees and so on, and the city is forthcoming, and we avoid some of the competition that is high-density student residential with their own private companies that compete with the city and the university for all of this transit. So I think that's absolutely critical in terms of making sure that we make some sense out of this whole thing. I mean, having said that, this is a no-brainer, right? I mean, we really do. We have a transportation sales tax that is split three ways, not evenly split, but it's split three ways generally between road repair, which we're sorely in need of. We have all these needs and not enough capacity, or not enough money. And the airport, which is an absolutely essential need that the university and we are interested in terms of economic development. And, of course, the transit system, which is historically subsidized because unless you can get a really robust model, is not a moneymaker. It's the kind of thing you absolutely need, but it's not the kind of thing that generates its own money. So we need some solutions to this. Getting a consultant to give us a handle on that is absolutely essential, and I'm certainly willing to endorse this and ask those questions, get those answers, and put something in place that can make some sense.
Anyone else? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 30315, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowser?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read B-313-15 and B-315-15.
Council Bill 313-15 is an ordinance amending Chapter 22 to repeal and reenact in place thereof a new Section 22-159 relating to residential refuse collection to prohibit roll carts for residential refuse collection and prohibit purchase or modification of refuse collection vehicles designed for automated residential roll cart refuse pickup. To repeal and reenact in place thereof a new section 22-159.1 relating to residential recycling collection to prohibit roll carts for residential recycling collection and prohibit the purchase or modification of refuse collection vehicles designed for automated residential recycling roll cart pickup and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading. Council Bill 315-15 is an ordinance calling a special election in the City of Columbia, Missouri to consider an initiative ordinance requiring the existing residential refuse and recycling collector and rate systems be maintained, prohibiting roll carts for residential refuse and recycling collection, and prohibiting the purchase or modification of refuse collection vehicles designed for automated residential refuse and recycling roll cart pickup, directing notification of the election authority, describing the form of the notice of election, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
The city clerk received a petition, initiative petition, from a group of citizens and certified that petition to the city council as having sufficient signatures on October 15th. According to the city charter, council is required to act within 30 days to determine whether or not you will pass that ordinance in its exact form as submitted by the initiative petition, or if you submit that to the voters for determination about whether or not it should be enacted. So that's the reason the city clerk read both of those items in conjunction, because it is an either or scenario. You are mandated by the charter to select one of those two ordinances tonight, which you desire to pass. Based upon the charter requirements, you don't have the option to make any amendments or alter the ordinance as it was presented in the initiative petition. The initiative petition would prohibit the use of roll carts for residential recycling and regular trash pickup. It would also prohibit the retrofitting of any vehicles, automated collection vehicles, for trash pickup to allow that, and would require you to maintain the current rate structure. No pay as you throw was a major a piece of that particular initiative language, so that's the reason that it was actually repealed and reenacted in its entirety, those particular sections. So it would also mandate the existing rate structure, and that you keep the existing black bag and recycling bag collection system. So that's really the effect of what the initiative petition would do. What you see in Bill 313 is for the council to adopt those changes by your own vote. Bill 315-15 is the bill to send it to the voters. If it goes to the voters, the next available election is the election date at which it gets presented for a vote, and that is the March 16th election, which is also the presidential preference election date. There was some question initially about whether or not the next municipal election would be in April, that city council election, but in talking with the Boone County clerk, the Secretary of State's office, and numerous other sources and legislative research, we did make the determination that if you placed the initiative on the March 16th ballot, it would be accepted.
It's the 15th.
I'm sorry, the March
15th.
Let's double check and make sure that's the way it's written in there. So in my head, I have March 16th, but that's the date that it is the presidential primary date, and it is available for municipal election purposes and for issues. So that's why the March date and not the April, in case you have any questions.
Nancy, does the ordinance say, in addition to prohibiting use of roll carts, it prohibits, I think I heard you say this, pay-as-you-throw using a purely bag system? That would be also prohibited if the ordinance is passed?
That is correct. And in the council, under the charter, the council is prohibited from making, if the voters approve or if the council adopts the ordinance, either way, you are prohibited for a period of 6 months from making any alterations to that ordinance unless it's done by unanimous vote of the city council.
Any other questions?
Yeah, if this goes to the voters and it is confirmed, it's passed, then how long is that in Is that a permanent decision then? Is that something that the council could look at in 5 years or 10 years, or is this?
6 months. That's the 6 month period. You have to, once it gets, if it gets approved, you have 6 months where you cannot make any alterations. And after that, you would have the ability to make alterations to it.
Because it seems difficult to keep the rates the same for a prolonged period of time.
That's correct.
Does that apply to the any alteration after 6 months would take a unanimous decision? But
no, any alteration within 6 months.
Within 6 months.
Has to be made with a unanimous vote of the council.
That's correct.
Any other questions?
I should point out the ordinance contains the correct date of March 15th.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The council memo had a typo of the 16th, so disregard the 16th, and so if you pass the ordinance as written, it'll be on the correct date.
Correct, Tuesday the 15th. It's my apologies. That's my error in the memo.
I have one question. If this goes to the voters as stated and it is defeated, would it automatically approve roll carts?
No.
Okay.
Council would still have the same consideration as to what you would want to do with roll carts or with the trash collection system. It could still remain the status quo.
Or it could go to bags or roll carts.
It could do any option.
Okay.
It
could do anything.
Go back to the same discussion we were having 2 years ago.
Okay.
Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Range Line. I just merely wanted to comment that I don't think this come up much. In the previous discussion, we looked at the elderly, knowing that elderly do have a lot of trouble in the wintertime trying to get up and down hills. This was mentioned on KFRU this morning. And as I look at it, it's a complete waste of money on two or three angles. We're looking at cost of elections. We're looking at the cost of investing in new trucks and just plain changes when the public said we don't want these. We keep forgetting the health issue, and this is so important. I do not think this has been stopped yet. If any of you have a memory of something called West Nile, where the mosquitoes start to come, because Joe didn't clean his trash can and Mary Jane forgot to and Larry said to heck with it. For you know it, we've got a new problem in Columbia and it could be the health side of the whole situation. I truly feel remembering back to when I had a sister who talked about horses coming down with this. In other words, if it ain't a human, it may be animals. And that's all the city needs is more controversy over getting the cans here, population when mosquitoes grow. Why? Water sometimes stands in the bottom of the trash can. There's all kinds of reasons to think about the health side. Thank you very much.
Anyone else?
Mary Ratliff, 211 Park DeVille Drive. I rise to ask the council, I would hope that you would just vote that you would not send this even to the voters, that you would vote this down tonight, because you know, I was thinking about, I have a neighbor next door who has a steep hill that comes down, you know, and so every year when the snow comes, she has to have somebody come tow her car up to her driveway, and I can just imagine her trying to go every week in the ice and snow down that steep hill to get that and try to get that. I can just imagine her trying to get that roll cart back up to her home up that hill. And I myself, I try to visualize, you know, what would happen with the roll carts at my home in the first place. You know, where are you going to store it? You know, to store it, I'd have to store it way around in the back, and in the wintertime bring it way around through the yard to the front in order to get it out to the roadside. So, and many older people will have a problem with those roll carts. So I would hope that you all would just, you know, do what's right for the citizens and what the citizens really, I believe that the majority of the citizens that I am talking to are asking, you know, you all to take the necessary action today so that it doesn't even have to go to the voters, because if it does go to the voters, I feel very confident that they will vote against those roll carts. So just take the positive and vote the right way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Number 1829 Cliff Drive. For those people concerned about getting their roll carts or trash to the curb, the city offers a program by which, if you have certain documentation, the city workers will pick up your trash, whether it's bags or roll carts.
Anyone else?
And Joan Wilcox, 1000 Madison, new into Columbia. I've been in Boone County a long time. This didn't occur to me until I thought about cleaning my roll cart and the one editorial that was in the paper about grandmas being afraid to be run over by roll carts and stuff, which I thought was pretty sarcastic and stuff. But I live in a rental now. I have no outdoor water, so it's going to be pretty hard for me to get that roll cart up my steps, through my living room, into my kitchen where I can clean it out. So there really are a lot of things to think about, particularly with the older rental places and hills and elderly people. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Anyone else? If not, we'll close the public hearing and go to council discussion.
Well, let me start this. I have the unenviable position of voting first by the luck of the draw here. And I've also been on the record by suggesting that I'm, you know, in a case like this, I'm in a position to represent the Third Ward. We've had lots of informational sessions. We've been through all the arguments, the pros and cons. Personally, I'm kind of torn between these issues. I see some of the benefits of the staff's position with regard to workers' compensation and efficiencies of economy and so on and so forth. I see some of the benefits and some of the drawbacks that people have expressed in terms of storage of roll carts, cleaning of roll carts, and not least of which is even the people's behavior with respect to taking care of these and not having roll carts out on the street for weeks at a time. I don't know how to deal with the behaviors. And frankly, if it were up to me, I would pass this along to the voters that the voters have, or at least the petitioners have spoken and said that they want input here. I would prefer that. I would prefer actually not to have to take a vote. On the other hand, I have to take a vote, and I also have to represent my Third Ward's constituents, which to the tune of at least two-thirds or three-quarters in the informational sessions that I have attended, that if I did not vote for this, even though I don't like the language exactly, I'd like to deal with some of the pay-for-throw and all the rest of it. I can't. There's nothing I can do about that. But I would be strung up from the nearest tree if I did not represent my constituents when they expressed that kind of an overwhelming support for this. If it's a 50-50 decision, that's one thing. You have to make a justification. You have to do the research. You have to make a legitimate argument to try and at least justify your position. I need not even do that at this point. I'm prepared to vote for this ordinance according to the petitioners on the first vote, but I would hope that the rest of the council, depending on what the discussion is, and I don't have the luxury of listening to this discussion before I make a vote, unless somebody wants to chime in here, would send it to the voters for a referendum. I suspect that the referendum may be closer than lots of people think. But nonetheless, I think that's the appropriate thing to do. That's how I'm going to vote tonight, and we'll see how the rest of the council deals with it.
Let me just say that I have great faith in the citizens, and I'm going to vote to send this to a referendum in March.
I can comment. I was reelected in support for roll cart choice. I support a hybrid system. There's some folks, you know, I feel for Lesson Mary Sapp and their quarter mile gravel driveway. Other folks with kind of steep areas, storage issues, not wanting a roll cart might be a reasonable choice, but not allowing me to have a roll cart strikes me as unfair. What I think is compelling argument is really gets into worker safety. We have a 45% annual turnover rate because people don't want to stay on these jobs because they're physically demanding, they're out in the elements, and weaving in and out of traffic is inherently dangerous and life-threatening behavior. All of our workmen's comp claims have a human element of someone who's experiencing those medical issues. And we as representatives of city government don't just have a role to play for our constituents, but we have a role to play with our city staff whose lives are influenced and risks are taken because of policies that we set. And those powers as a policymaker weigh heavily on me. And I am not comfortable taking a show of hands who shows up at a public meeting. I don't believe that the people who are most active, obviously the folks who put together this petition have an amazing amount of energy and enthusiasm and organizing capacity. We know that from the number of petition signatures that there's a significant portion of people who have issues with roll carts. The not wanting a roll cart, again, like I said, I have some sympathy and understanding for that, but not allowing me or other people who have concerns about worker safety or animals getting into the trash, the folks who have had lived in other communities that have roll carts and have positive experiences with those, most of the folks that I have talked to who have personal experiences with roll carts have been found them to be positive. The real essence of not us allowing us to have roll carts, which is what this ordinance does, really gets down to aesthetics, of that people think roll carts are ugly. And I get that. We all have. Some people think trash bags are ugly. Some people think animal-strewn trash is ugly. There's an aesthetic argument. But that pales in comparison to the safety of our workforce. And I think it's imperative for us to be leaders. Let's bring this to the vote. I found it compelling that all of the three online polls came out in favor of roll carts. In general, folks who are against things are more active, and online polls are unscientific because there's some motivation factors. But we certainly saw that in the public hearings, that the folks who are against roll carts were a lot more active and engaged in those processes. But the online polls look like they're pro-roll carts. So nothing's more democratic than giving the folks a chance to weigh in on the ballot box on how we're going to decide our policies. It seems the clearest choice in front of us is to send it to the voters. And let's see what, let's at least put a rest to the question of is Columbia universally against roll carts? I don't believe so. And I think that we should answer that question in the ballot box. That's the most democratic way to handle this.
I spent a long Monday morning a couple of months ago with one of the solid waste collection team, actually with two of the solid waste collection teams. I spent about an hour and a half in East Campus in your ward, Betsy, and then another hour and a half over in the fourth ward in the area of Rollins and kind of further west than Stadium. And it is a physically demanding job and a dangerous job. And I don't feel comfortable on the basis of that experience taking off the table a technology that can improve the safety of workers.
So I'm not willing to support this ordinance as written right now. I do think a vote of the people is the fairest way to do this, and we should have a good education campaign between now and March, assuming that that's what the council votes to do, so that everybody votes in the full knowledge of all of the different aspects of this decision.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple more comments here. I will have to concur that, you know, the people that came to the informational party meeting were certainly more likely leaning towards not having roll cards. But having individual conversations with constituents throughout my ward, whether it be at the grocery store, at the gas station, neighbors, and others, there's a lot of people that were equally as supportive of roll cards. And I've never made any, I've not, you know, come out and said I was either for or against roll carts. I think that the technology is something we certainly look at. I've thought a blended situation of having, you know, bags. But I have always and consistently said that I am a supporter of a pay-as-you-throw system. And how we accomplish that is either through bags or with roll carts. And so I will add, I have a 78-year-old father who has roll carts for recycling and his trash. He loves his roll carts. He pushes them up his incline on his driveway. He lives just an hour down the road in Wentzville, so he suffers the same climactic experiences that we do here in Columbia. So I concur that I think that this should go to the voters, and we will put this to rest one way or another on the outcome of that vote. And so I think, again, trust the voters to make their decision, become educated, and vote their conscience. And so this is their utility system, and what you run is how their utility system wants, how they want their utility system. And I think, again, taking this to a full vote of the people is democracy in action. So.
Well, I've said from the beginning that I wish that those who were in favor of roll carts were equally as passionate and organized as those who are against them. But as everyone else has said, you know, when you talk to individuals one-on-one, it is apparent that this is an issue that has divided our community, and it's kind of amazing to me that this has become the hot topic of the season. And so it is, in my opinion, appropriate to send it to the voters to make the decision rather than to sit here and make the decision in their behalf. I am concerned about the technology and worker safety and all of those issues that everyone else has spoke of. And so I'm encouraged to vote against this ordinance and to send it to the voters, because it at least gives us the opportunity to pursue a hybrid system, an alternative plan that is not as stringent as this ordinance has been written. So I will vote against it and in favor of sending it to the voters as well.
Anyone else? We'll ask the clerk to call the roll on 313-15, which accepts the language of the petition as an ordinance and obviates the need for an election. So please call B313-15.
Council Bill 313-15, Mr. Scala.
I'll vote yes in the hopes that I'm outvoted by the rest of the council so we can send out a new public referendum.
Mr. Thomas?
You said yes.
Yes, right? Okay. I said yes.
No.
Ms. Snauzer?
No.
Ms. Peters?
No.
Mr. McDavid?
No.
Mr. Ruffin?
No.
Mr. Trapp?
No.
B315-15 submits this to the electorate. Please call the roll.
Council Bill 315-15, Mr. Scala.
Thank you to the rest of the council. I'll vote yes on this.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Snauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 296-15, 297-15, 298-15, 299-15, 315, 302-15, 304-15, 305-15, 306-15, 308-15, 309-15, 310-15, 311-15, 312-15, and resolutions 168-15, 169-15, 170-15, 171-15, 172-15, 173-15, 174-15, 176-15, and 177-15.
Please call the roll.
Council bills 296-15, 297-15, 298-15, 299-15, 300-15, 302-15, 304-15, 305-15, 306-15, 308-15, 309-15, 310-15, 311-15, 312-15, and resolutions 168-15, 169-15, 170-15, 171-15, 172-15, 173-15, 174-15, 176-15, and 177-15. Mr. Scala.
Yes, and all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
Ms. Nowzer.
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Mr. McDavid.
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin.
Yes.
Mr. Trapp.
Yes. Under new business, please read R-175-15.
Council Bill 175-15 is a resolution authorizing the purchase of equipment from Civic Recycling to be used by the Utilities Department Solid Waste Division.
Staff, please.
This resolution is seeking authorization to purchase used recycling equipment from Civic Recycling. Civic Recycling ceased operation in September of this year, and the purchase of this equipment will allow Solid Waste to continue recycling services to these customers. The purchase price of the used equipment is $38,000. The cost of this equipment and future recycling revenue from this activity will be integrated in the collection operations. Staff is requesting this resolution be amended with the new Exhibit 8 is the reason why it was pulled from the consent, and to approve the resolution to authorize the purchase of this used equipment. And with that, to answer any questions on this.
Any questions?
So this is recycled recycling equipment?
Correct, it is. Yeah.
May I have a motion to amend R-175-15 for the amendment sheet?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Any questions about the resolution? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any discussion by council?
I'd like some comments. I think at my day job, we were a customer of Civic Recycling. It was unfortunate to see them go out of business. It points to the difficulties. Sometimes our solid waste division has been criticized in regards to the rates that we charge, and that this points to the difficulties of this this whole industry. It shows that the government does have a role in solid waste, that the private market is going to struggle to be able to do things that have more than just a bottom line component, although recycling has a huge bottom line component with diverting stuff from the waste stream, which otherwise has a cost, and also having some sale value, but it provides a social good. And so I'm pleased that the city is able to take this opportunity to get some equipment at a good price, but also that we're able to ensure the continuity of services for all those other providers that have those kind of commercial contracts. And so it's difficult to see a business go under, and I don't think that that's ever a good thing. So certainly my condolences for the folks at Civic. So, but I am pleased that we're able to help out their some of their commercial customers.
I just have a question. I just for informational purposes only, I know that the industry is having great difficulty because the price on recyclables is way down. To what extent has that affected our input, that is the local government's input into this whole system? Is it really, I mean, has it diminished our capacity to even look towards the future to try and develop this as a resource? Or, I mean, I know you're not prescient. You can't figure out what's going on in the future. But this has had a profound influence across the board for these private companies and perhaps the city, too. Have we, to what extent are we suffering from this whole thing?
Or are you basically approaching this question from a commercial perspective as far as what's the cost of the operations for recycling?
I'm representing a taxpayer, right? I mean, and the constituents and so on, and lots of them are interested in recycling. And we have a recycling program. We've been talking about farming some of this out to St. Louis, and say if that's a possibility, or enlarging our own capacity. Has the recent downturn in the amount of money that's available for recycling affected how we're approaching the answer to these questions?
becomes more expensive for all those considerations, because the anywhere else you will send it, they will charge more processing for less revenue. So we just have, you know, markets fluctuate with everyone. But in 2008, they went down a lot further to where it was in a negative. You're paying to get rid of some of them. We have not seen that
really
get anywhere near that yet.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 175-15 as amended. Mr. Scholar?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowser?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read R-178-15.
Council Bill 178-15 is a resolution approving the preliminary plat of Bear Creek Vistas.
Trapp, please.
This is a proposed preliminary plat of subdivision, and tonight's action only concerns a resolution for that preliminary plat. There's a companion case for the first phase of final plat of the lots that are intended to be created, but tonight's action is only to approve a preliminary plat. And just to review what that means, it's really a map of lots and street. It does not create the lots or the street in a legal sense, but it establishes a commitment to moving forward with that as a plan for future subdivision. So the area in this preliminary plat is 5 acres. The applicant, Mr. Jerry Kelly, desires to divide this 5 acres into 3 lots, and the 3 lots will be served by a new street that will interconnect Crazy Springs Road with the future extension of Blue Ridge Road, which is not yet established and not yet platted. This is the site. What's shown as Lot 1 is the proposed first phase. You will get a council bill to create Lot 1 as a final plat at a future date. It's the staff's requirement and the Planning and Zoning Commission's recommendation that the existing house on that lot be provided a public sewer connection to replace the existing private connection that runs across the rest of the property before that lot is created and enables the house to be sold. This is the prelim plat, and I'll just walk through the lots that are being created. There's that Lot 1 again, and it extends from Crazy Springs Road on the west to a future street to be called Salamander Lane. Then there's Lot 3, which is on the east side of Salamander Lane, and then Lot 2 on the west side of Salamander Lane to the south of the existing home and the lot that's desired to be created there. Salamander Lane takes its name from a planned street within a future phase, as yet unplatted, in what was originally known as Vanderveen Preliminary Plat 9, and I believe is now being rebranded as Willow Falls, and I think it was earlier this year council saw a plat for Willow Falls that extended that program a little farther to the west. So Salamander Lane would extend to Crazy Springs, and that would enable access for lots 2 and 3. The reason for the street, really a couple of reasons. One is our code does not allow new subdivided lots in R1 and R2 district to take private driveway access off of Creasy Springs Road. It's considered detrimental to movement and safety along that road to have a proliferation of additional private driveways. So the street is a means, on the one hand, to consolidate access to any new lots that are created. It would also address kind of a long-term planning problem, and that's how do you better interconnect the roughly parallel routes of Blue Ridge Road and Prairie Lane, which is to the south of this location. This is a large rural style tract that's really in between two subdivisions. There's future the future Willow Falls to the north, and there's the existing Prairie Estates to the south. So this would provide some better interconnection that doesn't rely completely on Crazy Springs to provide that interconnection. And as I said, you'll have the lot one will be at a future date. That's going to be a phase one of the final platting, and then presumably lot two and three, along with Salamander Lane, come in a future phase of final subdivision. And this is just animating how things may proceed. We'll call it a new residential connector street. The Crazy Springs realignment was described for the Planning and Zoning Commission. Don't want to lead anybody on. That's not a programmed improvement. It's something I think the city staff have recommended as a long-range project, but it's not in our capital improvement program in any of the in or out years. But the city has acquired property on the opposite side of Creasy Rings Road from this. Long term, it's conceivable that Creasy Springs Road could be realigned and the existing curved section of that road could be downgraded to a cul-de-sac. So you'd really have a very minor street connecting to Salamander Lane if that were the case. So this is a plan that would enable some continued connectivity if that occurs between neighborhoods north and south of this tract. And that's just showing what has been studied by the City Public Works Department as a potential long-range fix for the curve at Creasy Springs Road. I'll try to answer questions council may have.
Real quick, you said this new proposed road on this preliminary that would connect to another subdivision that was formerly Vanderveen, but they're rebranding it as something else.
Yeah, Willow Falls is the last phase that we did, some distance to the east of this location, and there's about 28 acres left to be final platted in what was originally Vanderveen 9.
So what is your projection on when that might come online?
It's going to depend on how fast I imagine the lots move and other financial factors.
So I guess my question is, because Creasy Springs is not on our next 10-year capital improvement project list, so if this new subdivision comes online, I can see an increase of traffic using that new connection onto Creasy Springs. Has anybody talked about any increased traffic on that road? Because that is certainly not an area we want any additional traffic. And so that would be my concern, is if this piece, if we approve this preliminary plat, that opens that gate to that property that in Vanderveen and then adding that traffic. What are we going to do about keeping that traffic off of Creasy Springs in that interim?
I can't tell you. I think that's probably something that would occur to just about anybody looking at the map. Mm-hmm. The major roadway plan calls for Blue Ridge to extend all the way to Creasy Springs. So
that's north of that, right?
And that's north of the curve. So that connection will be made.
Okay.
This would be built as a local residential street. It's something that we could take closer look at to forecast trips if the connection was fully made there at both ends. So
right, because I don't see anybody taking a right out of the Vanderveen subdivision to Creasy Springs. They're going to take the new extension down to Creasy Springs and dump out right on that curve. But it really doesn't matter which way they take. It's still going to add more traffic onto Creasy Springs, which I don't think I can support until we have that road straightened. I mean, we've had accidents there. We don't have a plan for it, and we constantly hear from those neighbors. And approving a preliminary plat today, we're obligated to approve a final plat tomorrow. And so I don't have enough information on this traffic and what we're going to do.
Yeah, another option would be to grant variance to allow private driveway access. The staff probably considered that and determined that public street access is in keeping with the ordinance, whereas the private driveway access would not be. But that's an option that would be available to council for something that's small in scale. Could be a lost opportunity, though, to do the interconnection through the neighborhood, because if Creasy Springs is severed and there's only a private driveway system there, you're really talking about a long interval between Prairie Lane and the Blue Ridge extension.
Tim, if Blue Ridge were extended and Creasy Springs realignment was not yet completed when this next plat, could Salamander just connect to Blue Ridge versus connecting onto Creasy?
Yeah, that's another possibility, is just make it terminate at the south end or do that on a temporary basis, depending on how the overall roadway plan shapes up. There's a lot in play here.
Of course, sure.
We could look at it just based on the existing conditions. You have a through route, so it's current conditions would call for a street that would only connect to Creasy Springs Road, because we don't have the Blue Ridge extension yet, and we don't have anything near a cul-de-sac there.
I've got a question. I'm really uncomfortable about this too. I mean, obviously that we've gotten a lot of press lately about the danger involved in this curve and so on and so forth. There may be some other options to make different connections to avoid putting any more traffic on this roadway until such time as we can make some arrangements to make this a safe. I'm really having a hard time dealing with increasing. I understand the predicament and I understand how interconnected this is, but as I understand it from you, there are some potential solutions, at least in the short term, that could accommodate this kind of thing without risking even more endangerment for the public in terms of this traffic way.
How many homes are going to be in this subdivision?
Three, sir. There'd be two new. There's one that already exists.
And the traffic count on Creasy Springs Road, as I recall, is 2,500 a day?
I can't tell you that's the latest count, but that sounds close to what would be its relatively low volume for its type.
Okay. Any other questions before we go open to the public?
Yeah, do we have any idea that should Blue Ridge and this new street to be put in, what the traffic count could possibly increase to? I don't know how many homes are back in Vanderveen in that area that would have access to that exit point rather than having to go all the way down to Range Line. I mean, I could certainly see people taking this as a easier and faster way to get in to downtown as opposed to taking the alternative going through their subdivision. And so, I mean, what the traffic count is today, but I'm not worried about today. It's tomorrow that we'll dump out on this dangerous road. So,
let's. Would anyone in the public like to speak?
Good evening. I'm Ron Luke, Luke Servain. I've got offices on College Avenue here in Columbia. I'm the one who prepared the preliminary plat and the final plat. But I did this at the direction of city planning of how they wanted to see this. We started off with J.D. Kelly buying this property 5 years ago in 2010. At that time, it had a house, a shack, a mobile home, and some junk cars on there. And what he did was clean the place up, remove the shack, remove the mobile home, rehab the house at number 3624 Creasy Springs with the desire to sell off the house of what he, you know, recoup some of his investment, sell off the house. And that's where we started with this thing, the house in 1 acre. What he tried to do was, what we tried to do in August was a track split, just sell off the house part, leave the rest of it sit. And that didn't fly with city planning. So we evolved to this, a preliminary plat. This is a stretch of what the 2006 conceptual plan is for the overall Creasy Springs relocation project. You can see that Creasy Springs is going to be a cul-de-sac at some point. Don't know how long it's going to be, but stop before this other Salamander Lane goes through there. But that was a plan from 2006. A 2007 plan that I saw that we were working off of after had this thing assembled, went through the duplex house on the corner of Creasy Springs, and right-of-way department like that, but Public Works did not, so we reverted back to this kind of a layout. And I did this with the assistance of city planning to, this is how they wanted to see it. It's going to, by default, besides the one lot with 1 acre in the house, create a lot two and a lot three that the owner has no intention of developing. I mean, that road is cost prohibitive to put in for two lots in there. And at this point, that's kind of a moot point. What he's trying to do is just sell off the 1 acre piece on the northwest part of this. It's got frontage on Greasy Springs with a driveway. When this came in to the city, a year after he bought it, it had three driveways, three newly installed 40-foot long culverts by the county. The county did a paving project on Creasy Springs. And that northern driveway just isn't that safe. And so we're doing on the first plat, we'll have a triangular easement to use the middle drive to get to this piece of property. But that's Salamander Lane will be a part of the whole Creasy Springs relocation project. It's not going to stand on its own. This won't be a connection from Creasy Springs up to Blue Ridge. That's got to take place. The whole relocation project and Blue Ridge coming through has to take place first before this would ever happen. And with that, if you've got any questions, I can answer them. Possibly.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the information.
Thank you, Tim.
Anyone else? Council comments?
I'd like to speak for this because it's in the second ward. There are a lot of moving pieces, but I think approving this would honor what the facts on the ground is, that someone purchased a property that had a lot of negatives to it and has taken some real steps towards cleaning up that area, eliminating two out of the three driveways, and really wanted a more simpler process. And staff also has some interest, and this is one of the things that I love about city government, is we take a very long view. And so we're not just looking at what's happening on the facts on the ground right now, which is this site's getting cleaned up, this home is getting improved, and there's good things in regards to the amount of access onto Creasy Springs, but we're looking at that interconnectivity in the future. From my conversations with the developer of Willow Falls, that's not going to be a quick process. There was some push that I received to try to get that Blue Ridge connection made, because the folks on Prairie Lane, who used to not have connectivity, suddenly found that they wanted it when they were flooded out and there was no one who could get to their neighborhood for 9 hours. Once it was granted, now there's more traffic moving through their neighborhood, and they have a little buyer's remorse about that connectivity. So I engaged in this conversation on, and this is where we're at, as we have taken with energy efficiency standards and sewer connectivity fees and things that we've done that add value to our community and that put more of the costs of new development on new development. One of the, I won't say unforeseen, but one of the other byproducts of this process is we've raised the cost of what it takes to build a house. There is also an upper threshold of what people will pay for a house north of I-70 because of ongoing perceptions about crime and just where people prefer to live. It's really kind of closed that gap, where that gap between how much it costs to build a house and how much are people willing to pay for a house is not very big. And so development has really slowed down in the second ward. We were one of the fastest growing wards, and now we're not really growing much at all. And so a lot of our plans have come to naught, which is a real kind of cautionary tale about the limits of long-range planning. As much as I love it and I think that it's important, we do have to pay attention to the facts on the ground. I'd hate to see this property owner put by having it voted down because of things that he didn't want to put in front of the plan. He just wanted to divide the lot. And city staff is trying to protect our long-term interests in regards to neighborhood connectivity in honor of the plan, but then it raised some questions about the current state of Creasy Springs, and the last thing we want to do is dump more cars onto that. Blue Ridge is going to come or it's not. It has nothing to do with this project, and most of those cars are going to come through. If there is Blue Ridge, if it does come to pass that Blue Ridge connects, in the unlikely event that Lot 2 and 3 do and Salamander Lane, I don't think we're going to get a lot of people coming off of Salamander Lane versus going up to the better sight lines. I believe we also have some discretion about granting that access based upon sight lines and some traffic engineering studies when it, if it came down to that final plat, although Ms. Nauser does make a great point about a preliminary plat decision is kind of important and binding because plats are a ministerial action if they meet everything, but I question of whether it would meet those requirements under this scenario of Creasy Springs not having that straight, being straightened out. So it's a complex issue. They dug into it deep in planning and zoning. Definitely Mr. Teddy was informed by that conversation and I think gave a really good overview and presentation. But if you're not familiar with that area, it can be tricky. I appreciate the surveyor coming out and giving his perspective. In the long and the short of it, I would encourage my colleagues to grant this preliminary plat because I think it does justice to the current property owner, recognizes the immediate interest of what's happening there right now, and also aligns with the comprehensive plan to ensure some connectivity if those two pieces in the far-flung future come to pass.
Let me make a comment. Heading into this, I was very skeptical. Primarily, Ms. Nauser's presentation is pretty compelling. I mean, we know this is a problem area because of this curb and so on. We have not addressed that problem. We should address the problem. I'm not exactly sure how it has not yet been addressed or not yet been adequately addressed. On the other hand, I'm inclined to defer to Mr. Trapp in his judgment. Particularly, the most compelling part of this argument has to do with the property owner trying to do the right thing, clean up his property, make this a little bit simpler, and so on. It's hard to hold somebody hostage that's doing the right thing, even if it's for a principle that may not be realized until somewhere on down the road. Excuse the pun. But this may take quite a while. I do take a bit of umbrage, Mr. Trapp, with this idea that north of I-70, it may be true. I don't know, but your ward in particular, whether things have slowed down, still going pretty great guns in the northeast. I suppose a lot of that is driven by Battle High School and so on and the potential for annexation and whatnot. And frankly, I would encourage, there's some real bargains to be had north of I-70. I've lived north of I-70, I don't know about you, but I lived north of I-70 since 1980 for a long time. I kind of like it up there, some of us barbarians that live up. But nonetheless, that notwithstanding, with this issue in particular, and given your knowledge of the Second Ward in this particular area, and the attention to it, and the property owner really doing the right thing, I see at this point a little risk in that little bit of additional activity on that road, although I think it's absolutely essential that we pay some attention to this, maybe even move it up on the CIP plan so that we can solve some of these problems at this very dangerous intersection for the future in particular.
Let me just say that I appreciate Mr. Trapp's analysis of it. It's convincing to me. With respect to the road, we have asked for traffic calming, signage, whatever, and I do expect that to be forthcoming in a report. I'm not sure what staff has in mind to slow the traffic down there, but the problem, of course, is you have a straight road with a 90-degree turn. And really not a lot of signage on the way. And so there are ways of addressing that temporarily at very little cost that I presume the city will be moving forward with forthrightly.
Well, I will speak And say that I appreciate Mr. Trapp's explanation and discussion on this issue. I will defer as well to what you have said and talked about the property and the property owner. But I will, you know, again, maybe this will put light the fire under council and city staff to maybe look at this area a little more closely in the next the next capital improvement initiative coming up in 10 years from now. But I will also like to say that I would remind people that what brings this to my mind so vividly is, since I've been on the city council dealing with the traffic issues and safety issues on Forum, where Wilson's is. And so, you know, that was one thing we never looked at, unintended consequences of some of our platting and zoning decisions. And so hopefully we will heed what we've learned from that and get on this area of our community for safety and road connectivity, et cetera. So I will support this, even though I am hesitant to do so.
Any other comments? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 178-15, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Introduction, first reading. Please read the bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 316-15, 317-15, 318-15, 319-15, 320-15, 321-15, 322-15, 323-15, 324-15, 325-15, and 326-15, first reading.
Report 105-15, staff.
You trying to find a particular slide, or
trying to get the thing started? So I think we've got it now.
Sorry. Okay, I have a brief presentation for you. We provided you with a lot of information, I think, in the report that is in front of you. But I wanted to supplement that information with a little bit of information on our program. What we're basically asking Council to consider as a result of this report following the presentation is if you should desire to re-implement the red light camera system that we had operating until November of 2013 with some changes. You should direct staff to prepare legislation relating to automatic traffic control systems in compliance with this recent Supreme Court ruling, and I'll get into that in just a minute. And obviously, the red light cameras that we had in use for from 2009 through 2013, they have all been taken out. They were taken out in the beginning of 2014. We had a contract with a vendor named Gatso USA who spent the capital to put those that program together. They did a lot of our initial review of red light cameras, all the violations. They paid for maintenance of those cameras. And during the time period 2014, that contract expired. And so right now we have no contract, so we would need to go out for a new request for proposals process should you decide to re-implement that particular program. As I said, this, just as a little history lesson, our first approach was installed in September of 2009, and that was the Providence and Broadway approach you see there. That approach was then quickly followed by the approach at Stadium and Worley, Northbound Stadium at Worley, then Stadium and Forum, and both North and Southbound approaches at Providence and Stadium. As I said, we provided you with a lot of national statistics, and I'm going to provide you with a little bit of information in terms of some of the local data that we've been able to collect over the last few years, as well as looking at some of the non-biased sources that we think that are out there with regards to the benefits of red light camera programs. I think Mark Twain popularized the quote that there are three kinds of lies, lies, damn lies, and statistics. And you've seen a lot of statistics so far, and numbers are certainly important. But you have to understand how to interpret the numbers, and I'm hoping that what you'll see tonight in terms of some of the graphs and data that we put together will show that red light cameras, at least in Colombia, have certainly had an impact in terms of reducing the number of accidents, serious accidents, at those intersections during the time at which they were actually operating. This was a slide I got from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety, which is kind of a little bit surprising. They did a survey of several thousand respondents who reported driving in the last 30 days, and you can kind of see the results there. Approximately 70% of folks who responded said that red light camera running was completely unacceptable. 64% said they were a very serious threat, but almost 37% said that they did so in the past 30 days, which is kind of a scary statistic. When you look at Colombia's program, and I think some of the reference literature that we provided you with the report certainly says that red light cameras are certainly not the overall solution to red light camera running. And I think when you look at the way that we implemented our program here in Colombia, you'll see that we used a comprehensive approach that looks at all three of the issues there that we've highlighted for you, first being engineering, second being education, and the third and last one being enforcement, which is the actual red light camera itself. In terms of engineering, you have to make sure that obviously the intersections are well signposted. They all were. That backlights were installed on the red lights themselves to make sure that they were truly visible, make sure there were no sight obstructions from people actually approaching that intersection. Those are the sorts of intersection improvements that needed to be made before you actually install red light cameras. We have an agreement with MoDOT, and so MoDOT also requires all of these same types of things to happen before we actually implement red light cameras. So this little chart here was also provided by MoDOT, and it gives you, again, the three things that are important when you're trying to aim at reducing the incidence of red light violations at various intersections through the city. As you can see, if somebody didn't see the signal, or they were confused by the signal, or they were unable to stop the vehicle, a lot of those relate to engineering changes that are needed at those intersections. It's only when you have people that simply intentionally run red lights, they're following another vehicle too closely, they tried to beat the yellow light, which is a lot of the reasons why we have red light violations. At that point in time, you have bad behavior, and certainly whether it's an automated traffic enforcement system that issues the ticket, or if it's a police officer who happens to see that person violate that red light, enforcement is what deters bad behavior. And hopefully you'll see the impact of these red light citations over the period that we actually operate those cameras. In terms of our initial methodology, again supporting the fact that we just didn't choose five or six intersections in Colombia and say, okay, we're going to make a lot of money here, let's go ahead and put red light cameras up. We had GATSO USA contract with a local civil engineer, Allstate Consultants, who actually came in and did a detailed site evaluation of these 23 intersections that we provided. We got this data from, in terms of the potential for these locations, from comments from our traffic division, as well as our police departments in terms of the number of handwritten citations that they'd written over a period of time. So they looked at all of these. We actually had survey consultants on the ground at each one of these intersections at certain points of the day, typically rush hour from about 8 a.m. to noon, and from 3 to 6, so several hours during the day, actually counting the number of people that violate that particular red light. And these were the numbers that we got, and I just put the four intersections there that we actually installed. At the time that they did Providence Stadium, they counted 81 violations during that time period that I mentioned. Stadium Forum 25, Stadium Worley 56, Providence Broadway and 47.
What was that time period, Tony?
It was a period of just one day during rush hour from 8 a.m. to noon, and then from 3 to 6.
And was that the full scope of their study, just to count how many people?
Oh, no, that was just part of it. I mean, the other thing that they did with the intersection analysis was actually to look at all of the things that I mentioned early in terms of was there a clear line of sight by a person that was driving the vehicle so they could clearly see the red light, there was no obstructions. They looked at several other factors to make sure that if we could make some engineering improvements to those intersections that would hopefully decrease those numbers, we should make those changes first. At these particular intersections that I highlighted there that we ended up installing, there were none of those obstacles found. And so at that point in time, it was determined that there was enough red light violations occurring at those particular locations that warranted the installation of red light cameras.
I'm sorry to interrupt again.
Yes.
So by saying they ran the red light, was that they're looking that the front of the car went across into the intersection after the light turned red, or were they counting the taillights of people who were already three-quarters of the way through the intersection when the light turned red?
They were simply counting the actual number of red light violations, and a red light violation means that at the time that the light turns red, the vehicle was initially behind the stop bar, but it continued to proceed into the intersection and was still on red at that time.
Thank you.
I wanted to show you if this works, and it looks like it might. I think some of you have seen this before. This is, again, looking at some of the national numbers, and I think they support some of the local numbers that you'll see here. But this was a report that was put together in, I think, 2012 by ABC that I wanted to play. It just lasts a couple of minutes, and it will really show you what the impact of red light running can do and what it can mean to a family.
And tonight we have a driver's warning for every American family. The police have placed a video online as a lesson for everyone behind the wheel. Senior national correspondent Jim Avila explains.
Demolition derby on a city street. A speeder takes flight after he runs a red light and T-bones an innocent motorist. It's caught on four separate cameras at an intersection in Roselle Park, New Jersey. Police releasing this video as a warning that they take red light running seriously because it's responsible for the most deadly type of accidents. One in five crashes are caused by red light violators. This is the liftoff point, a dangerous accident, but not uncommon. In fact, these cameras show that across the country at each intersection, someone runs the red light once every 20 minutes. Florida's Melissa Wandel lost her husband to a red light runner.
They think when somebody runs a red light, there's either near misses or everybody's okay. And then you hear about the ones, like my husband, that Mark, who were killed.
Cities and towns across the country fighting back. More than 500 in 25 states have installed red light cameras to crack down. And it seems to be working. Less serious rear-enders are up because of panic stops. But fatal accidents are down nearly 25%. New York City reported a 34% decrease in red light violations since installing their cameras. New Orleans down a whopping 85%, and Council Bluffs, Iowa down 90%. The insurance industry says drivers are afraid of tickets and fines.
The thing that really gets drivers to change their behavior is heavy enforcement of laws. And that's the case with red light running.
And the cameras have told us something about who's running these lights most often. Men with bad driving records, often distracted by their cell phones, causing terrible crashes like this one, in which the speeder, who turned out to be drunk, somehow walked away. Jim Avila, ABC News, Roselle Park, New Jersey.
And come.
So this program, when it was installed in 2009, early 2010, it seems to be working the way we intended. It's kind of a self-diminishing program. We anticipated that as we issued more citations, as people became more aware of the fact that their driving was being monitored at various intersections, that hopefully the number of red light citations that we issued at these intersections would go down. And certainly over the period from early 2009 until when the program was ended in 2013, again, this is just five intersections in Columbia, the number of red light citations issued actually declined by 50%. You can see in 2010, we were issuing somewhere around 1,800 violations or citations per year. When the program ended in 2013, we were issuing around 900. If you look at the accompanying statistics, again, as you would hope that more people were aware of them, you would also hope that it would have its impact on the total number of accidents. And certainly, as you saw from the national piece with ABC, here in Columbia, these were statistics from our police department. I asked them to give me the total number of accidents at these red light camera intersections during the same time period that they were in operation, actually through September of 15. And you can see again that when we started this program in fiscal year 10, we were close to 170, 175 accidents per year at these intersections, and we ended in September of 15 at around 128. Yes, Carl.
Just a question, and that is the number, obviously, that the video was compelling, and certainly these are tremendous accidents if somebody runs a red light. But there has been no separation in this data, this local data, between rear-end accidents, which are presumably less severe but than running the red light, and the calls to any particular intersection and fatalities. We don't have that, though. We don't have those numbers, do we?
Have
there been any fatalities?
I think there has been, looking back at the data during that period, I believe there was one fatality.
Because of a violation of the red, somebody ran the red light, essentially.
That's correct.
Has this been documented on the red light cameras? I mean, in terms of that particular, curious.
It would have been basically the red light cameras are running, 24 hours a day.
So this fatality occurred at an intersection where there was a red light camera and it was attributable.
I would have to check back to make sure that fatality was at a red light camera intersection, because I did ask for any fatalities, but I'm not sure. I don't want to say comprehensively that it was at one of these intersections. It was at an intersection. I think there was one fatality as a result of red light running. It might not have been at one of these intersections.
And what dates did our camera program run from?
From September of 2009 through November of 2013.
But we had a decline in accidents after we stopped the red light camera program.
Which is great, I think. I'm not sure that everybody in Columbia knows that we ended our red light camera program. I think when we have red light cameras installed at just the five intersections, which we did for 4 years, I think there's a spillover effect to a certain extent, because you could ask pretty much anybody if we had red light cameras and they would say yes. If you ask them specifically what intersections were being monitored, they couldn't tell you.
You know, this is kind of interesting, because I remember when this first came down many years ago and we were talking about this, and we kind of made the suggestion half tongue-in-cheek that if we just put one camera and rotated it in various places and not told anybody which place it was in, it might have the same kind of an effect.
Yeah, that is actually done in the UK. For speed cameras, they put up thousands of these kind of nondescript gray boxes, and you could not tell whether there was a camera in it or not. The boxes were cheap, the cameras more expensive, and they were moved around. And it was very effective.
Well, one thing that really stuck out for me, other than the sensationalism of the ABC story, I mean, that's the worst of the worst, but it did make a very interesting component of tickets and fines. And I think I read in one of the local news sources that our fines are $120 for running a red light.
That is correct.
So if tickets and fines are the precursor to people making a better decision, why are we not increasing our fines? And I mean, I'm thinking about when I'm driving down the highways and you see the signs, hit a worker, kill a worker, whatever it says, fines are doubled. I've been to other states that, speeding in this section of road will result in a double fine. It seems to me, have we even looked at that as a solution to deterring people's bad behaviors, of increasing fines to where it actually impacts somebody? I mean, $100, $120 doesn't seem to be weighted to the potential gravity of running a red light and killing somebody. And again, putting up those signs, they seem to have the same deterrent effect, because they would certainly be more cost effective to put signs, running a red light is a double fine or $500 fine.
It's almost impossible to catch people if you don't have the cameras.
But if the psychology, if we're going off after the cameras, we're no longer here, but the rates of people running red lights decreased, then people were thinking somewhere there's a red light camera and I'm going to get a ticket. So if they thought they were going to get a severe ticket or a fine, would that not have the same psychological impact on people that, hey, I better slow down, because I know when I'm driving in a work zone, I make sure I put it on cruise control 5 miles an hour or less, because I don't want to get a ticket or a fine. When I've been in other communities and I've been with other people who are driving and they have, you know, areas of their road or times of days that they, give double fines,
people's behaviors change. We may want to consider a larger sign that says fines will double at monitored intersections, right?
Well, I'm not for cameras, but I'm just looking at...
I think, as Mr. Thomas said, the difficulty, you can certainly do that. But again, the issue is, are you going to have an enforcement office spending their time at those intersections to actually enforce this? What we're trying to do, I think, here is to use technology to make sure that we know bad behavior is occurring. We've seen that from the number of citations that we started out with when we issued this program at just 5 intersections. I mean, compared to looking at citywide red light citations, I asked the police department, during this period of time, 2005 through currently, how many tickets were you issuing citywide? And this is, they just happen to be at the right place at the right time. They're able to get through the intersection easily and apprehend the person. And you can see the number of tickets that an officer issued are minimal. But again, I think the fact that we saw a decline in the number of red light citations, I think, points to the spillover benefits that we had with folks thinking that we had a red light camera enforcement program in Columbia. I think it pays good benefit to that. But again, really quickly to Ms. Nazar's point, I'm not saying that red light cameras are the cure-all and end-all to everything. I mean, certainly there are other ways to curb bad behavior. Other municipalities, if you go to California and you get a red light violation, which is captured on a red light camera, the fine is $465. So certainly council, it's up to council if they decide that they want to raise fines and potentially still use red light cameras to actually capture those violators. I think that would be a double deterrent to people actually running red lights.
What were the absolute numbers caught by the cameras?
Here we go.
Again? Okay, so 1,700 versus about 300.
Again, citywide.
Officers.
That's correct.
With the officers, we can only capture a small.
I said they
percentage.
Have to be in the right place at the right time, and they have to be able to safely make it through the intersection, which creates a lot of problems also.
But wouldn't your comment just stand to say that we're not catching them? If the goal is to decrease bad behavior, why do we have to catch somebody if it's going to decrease their bad behavior? So that just plays into the point that we're doing this to generate revenue.
I've got a couple of slides with regards to revenue. I'm not saying that there's no city in the United States that doesn't use this as a revenue producer, because I guarantee you there is.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. I'm not saying we are either, but I'm just...
In 2014, the Mayor Emanuel, I think, said that he was going to balance his 2014 budget by using $120 million in red light fine revenue, which is something that we're not doing. We're basically trying to show that red light citation or red light running in Columbia has been an issue. It has declined, and it has declined due to our implementation of red light cameras. And I'll talk a little bit about the revenue that will actually hopefully show that this program, the way it was instituted, as I said, it needs to be a threefold enforcement: engineering, education, and enforcement. And I think with that approach that we've used, this certainly has not been a money-making operation. And I have some slides to show you, but I showed you the national story in terms of the ABC story, but I wanted to show you really how just a split second. Fortunately, we haven't had any fatal accidents to speak of at these intersections. At least I don't think so. There might have been one, but certainly a split second can make a huge difference in terms of, if I can get this to play, and I've got about 3 of them in a row, they just run very quickly. This particular one, the red light has been red for 4.2 seconds. As you kind of see, another second later, that van that's coming, it's about to turn, would have turned right in front of them. Here's another one. Again, the red light has been on red for 4.36 seconds at Stadium and Worley, and you can see it's on red. Oncoming traffic's about to turn, and again, somebody's about to blow through that intersection without regard for the red. Finally, let's see, this is now the same one. Let me go to the next one.
Are these going at real speed?
These are going at real speed.
Okay.
These are going at real speed.
But slowed down.
Here, you can take a look at this truck that's about ready to turn. Again, turn to the left here. The light is already on red. And again, another second longer, and you would have had a serious T-bone accident at this particular intersection if you'd turned just a second earlier. And then finally, for those people that have kids, here's a school bus. Again, you can see the light is on amber at this point in time, but as it turns red again, you will see that the school bus ignores it and continues to go through during very wet and rainy conditions. Certainly, you've heard a lot from the opponents. This has been a story that's been out there in the media for some time. This was a challenge that I read, I think, on one of the media sites. Will the council believe GATSO's claims? GATSO, again, was our red light camera vendor. Or will they recognize red light cameras for what they are, a fear-mongering, high-tech, cash cow intrusion into our lives and pocketbooks? I think some folks have asked if, you know, why are we sending all this revenue to a third-party vendor? Why not buy the equipment yourself? Why not install it yourself? And so you can kind of counteract that. Looking at the revenue by fiscal year, you'll see from fiscal year 2009 through 2014, the gross red light camera revenue received was $447,000 at $120 per citation. Payments to GATSO during that same time period totaled $210,000, leaving us a net of about $237,000. Now, you have to realize that GATSO had to do all the intersection surveys. They had to install all the conduit at all those intersections. They had to install the camera systems. They had to maintain and operate those systems. They had to employ people to actually look at every one of the violations that occurred to make sure it was a true violation. And so I put together a spreadsheet that showed what their expenses were during this time period, and there they are. Constructing the intersections, $160,000. Designing them, $19,000. Just the camera systems themselves cost almost $400,000. So you'll see during that period that they had cameras here in Columbia, they actually lost over $500,000. So if Columbia decided, okay, we don't want to use third-party vendors, we want to do it ourselves, you're looking at a cost of somewhere close to about $735,000 for us to operate our own system.
So how does the GATSO business model work for them?
It didn't work very well here in Columbia for them at all.
But what's different in other cities?
I think a lot has to do with the city's willingness to install red light cameras. As I said, our contract with GATSO called for us to install these cameras at 16 intersections in Columbia. We gave them the list of the 23 that I showed you earlier that we thought were potential candidates. But once we did the surveys, we looked at the engineering, we looked at the site distance, everything that could improve those, we only came up with those five. And so they were constantly on us to say, you know, we need to do additional surveys. And at some point in time, we said, you know, we've looked at all the candidates that we think.
So they probably hoped that over time we would add cameras
additional intersections.
And once they have more intersections in a single city, it kind of the
would hopefully the pay for itself.
Makes more sense. I'm just trying to understand the economics of
but
this.
Certainly not with the five approaches that we had, the five intersections that we had, they lost money.
Many states, I'll jump in, they treat it more like a parking violation than a points off your license thing. So if anybody drives your car through a red light, you get the ticket, and they just mail it to you. Here in Missouri, we've had that argument back and forth in the courts.
Because we did that for a while, didn't we?
Very short while.
But before it was stopped.
But before it was, the driver had to be the owner of the car to assess the. So.
And that means that when somebody's driving somebody else's car, they're
right,
essentially immunized.
Right, they would just toss that.
Was it
80% of the
That's why we
came. Violations
were absolutely we were losing about I think in terms of dollars it was around $220,000 a year, and so you're right, for the first 4 years of the program we operated under the principle that the driver was the one liable. It was only during that brief period from August through November of 2013 when there were a couple of court cases, or actually one court case that came out that kind of we thought gave us guidance on the fact that we could ticket the owner, that we changed our program. So,
and what was the 80%, 20% figure you just gave?
If I remember the number right, 80% of the violations caught on camera were never processed because we couldn't prove who the driver was.
The photograph of the driver's face didn't match the photograph of the owner of the vehicle. Either because
quality
or because
quality was quality is a big thing.
Lent the car to somebody else, or a child, or something.
And I also understand that at least someone testified to this, and I guess it's kind of a cops and robbers thing. But there is now a new economic development opportunity for paint that can be put onto a license plate that obscures the reflection from the flash from the camera, but does not obscure seeing the license number without a camera taking the photo. That's what I understand.
I actually looked that up, and my source on that is a very highly regarded source. It's a TV show that's on called Mythbusters. And they actually tested it, and apparently it actually works. When you're looking at the license plate, it appears to be a normal license plate, but apparently when a camera takes a photo of that license plate, the glare on it for some reason distorts the image of the license plate. So, again, if somebody wants to do that and deceive local government, they could.
Under the state law now, we can't do license plates anyway, can we? Is that correct?
Well, we have to capture a copy of the license plate to figure out.
We have to get a license plate and
The driver and the face to actually match them up. That's correct. That's correct.
Let me give my take on this. I appreciate this report. This is really, you've done a great job with this, and the information from our history with the cameras is really very interesting. You know, you gave us a couple of options, which was to either buy Gatso or Gatsco?
Gatso. Yep.
Gatso's line, or to be money grubbing, you know, whatever. I really don't accept either one of those premises. And my view on this is indeterminate. And what that means to me is that, for me, this is all about public safety. If it adds to public safety convincingly, you know, that's our obligation to provide public safety. But we just don't have the data to support that. We have a history of it, and you can speculate why the decline in intersection accidents occurred when the cameras were removed. That's all speculation. But the decline occurred after the cameras were removed. I think this is something to keep open as an option for the future, to follow the traffic patterns at these intersections. You know, do the collisions increase? You know, what does the other data around the country show? So for me, I think there's enough resistance community-wide for this that I personally need more compelling evidence that the public safety is clearly enhanced by red light cameras. And I just do not see that at this time.
I'll concur with you on that. I voted against the red light cameras before, and I say that I will do so again for varying reasons. But I still don't want to discard the fact that I think we could use other solutions to address some of these issues. And I'm just going off of an email that somebody contacted me with, of actually looking at the actual perception reaction times on these lights, poorly painted street line, you know, the lines on our streets. You can go to any of those intersections, and you show one of those when it rains. I've pulled a horse trailer down some of these roads in the night on the rain, and you can't see where you're going. And so, I mean, that is, and so just the weather was an issue from the one slide you showed. So are we looking at those types of things? Are we making sure that at these troubled intersections, the lines are clearly delineated and show people where they need to stop? They were talking about the failure to use large lenses on some of these lights. So is that an option that we could do, is change some of our light fixtures? And they were talking about having some backing plates on their lights, too, to prevent glare during certain times of the day. So these are all low-cost options that we could certainly do to help improve safety at our intersections and, quite frankly, all across the community, especially going back. That's been a complaint of mine for a decade, is the inability to keep stripes on our streets. And so I will concur with the mayor, and I think we can just keep this in our back pocket for another day.
I'd I don't mean to add any additional stress to you, Mr. Mayor, since you're retiring from this office, but I tend to agree with you almost 100% on this. Maybe that's a de-stressor. I'm not sure how this will work out. But you know, this goes back a long ways. When the red light cameras were first instituted, Darwin Hyneman was the mayor. Both Laura and I were on the city council. We both voted against it. I didn't think it was a good idea then. I would be willing to change my mind if there were some compelling evidence to the contrary, because I think public safety is paramount in all of this. I think there may be other ways to deal with this public safety thing, not the least of which is just signage to make sure that people, or at least they think something is going on at an intersection that could be important. And I'm not convinced that, although it's very true that people running red lights can have hugely disastrous kinds of outcomes, I'm not convinced that there isn't a large increase in just rear-end collisions. Not that that's is, you know, that doesn't involve fatalities. Usually could involve some injuries and so on. So I just don't think it's worth the investment. I think there are other ways to get at this. There's no question about the fact that there are lots of violations. Maybe, you know, as stressed as we are with the police department and their reactive policies for very serious crimes, it's kind of difficult to envision somebody sitting at a red light to monitor this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, occasionally, on an occasional basis, on a random basis, maybe that too could be brought to bear. I don't buy the argument that this is really a cash cow for everybody. I don't think that was the intention that this city made, and I don't think, obviously, it doesn't bear out in the numbers that the company that we contracted with made. But I just think there may be alternative solutions that don't involve this kind of technology. And God knows, there's been a lot of refutation in the courts because of all kinds of problem issues with red light cameras. I'm not a fan, and I continue not to be a fan.
Well, I'm going to differ, and I'm going to make the motion to direct staff to go forward with legislation. And I hope that the three people that haven't committed one way or the other, one of them's left, are going to support me. And we can have this further discussion at the time that the ordinance is brought forward. But somewhere between 40,000 and 50,000 people are killed on America's roads every year, and more than a million injured in these kind of crashes. And I think we really have to bear that in mind. We've somehow become immunized to these crashes and the devastating injuries and fatalities that they cause as sort of something that we just can't really avoid. And I disagree with that. There's a very rapidly growing movement across the U.S. called Vision Zero, which does not accept that people have to die and get maimed on our roadways. And the kind of strategies that they bring in are effective. They've been done in New York. They've been done in San Francisco. They've been done in Seattle. New York's is the longest program, and they've seen dramatic reductions in death and injury for motorists, pedestrians, and bicyclists on the streets of New York City. And they involve slowing down traffic and enforcing the law consistently and effectively. So I am not ready to throw out this tool. The data to me looks pretty compelling, and I'm really surprised to hear all of the opposition. I don't see the downside to these cameras, really. I don't see the downside. There isn't even people have said there are alternative low-cost solutions, but there's, as far as I can work out, there's zero cost to this in the kind of structure contract we would have with the private company. I'm not very enthusiastic about a third-party company, making a business out of this when it's really an enforcement activity. It's a bit like privatizing our prisons. But on the other hand, we would have to find $700,000 to even just launch the program, and so I guess we could borrow that and pay it off as the fines come in, and we see them. But that's messy. There's a ready-made tool here. It's been cleared legally. Seems to me it's going to be a net benefit to this community to improve enforcement of very, very dangerous activities. So I'm going to make a motion to direct staff to prepare legislation amending Chapter 14 of the City Code relating to automatic traffic control systems, red light cameras, in compliance with the recent Supreme Court ruling, and authorize the city manager to initiate a request for proposals process for the installation, operation, administration of a red light system.
Well, we have a motion. Is there a second? Lacking a second, the motion dies. Any other conversation about this?
I will add the inability, because of our police staffing issues, to do enforcement, I think, is the strongest piece of staff's argument. I think you're really undercut by the local safety data, which has had it steepen the dive after we removed the cameras. I think I got to go with the mayor that we should keep an eye. If we do see them increasing and with falling rates, I don't think there's a compelling reason to move forward. There is a cost in that there's at least, and I think Columbia has acted with honor in regards to red light cameras. I really do. I think it was about safety, and it may have garnered some modest effects, or it could have just been falling rates, hard to say, without control data from the first time we looked at the local data. But I don't think there's a compelling reason to hit that hornet's nest unless we see safety data that supports it.
Just one brief comment. I respect your opinion. I just don't want anybody to get the wrong impression that we can't do something or aren't doing something about the very dangerous conditions that these kinds of things engender. And I'm wondering if we can't just ask. I mean, I don't want to lie to anybody saying that we have a camera at an intersection mm-hmm. where there is no camera. I mean, that's duplicitous. That's wrong. There's something wrong with that whole thing. But there's no reason why we couldn't put signs at intersections that have lots of these potential violations, signs that say something about how dangerous these intersections are, and remind people to pay more attention to the lights at those intersections, because they are dangerous. It's hard to put on a little sign.
It is, yeah. That would really be a question for MoDOT, because every one of these intersections was MoDOT.
Okay, well, MoDOT. So. But maybe that's a question we ought to ask MoDOT, because, that would be a less expensive alternative. And frankly, I think the power of this is warning people that they're going to potentially get a ticket at the intersection. I think they would pay some attention, even if they were warned, if there wasn't the consequence of getting a ticket. I don't know that. I'm just saying I think that these signs have some value, and maybe that's a question we ought to ask MoDOT.
I agree. Anyone else? Thank you very much for this very complete report. Report 10615 is a report proposing $15,000 for Rockquarry Park, which is a low enough number that it doesn't require council approval. It's an administrative public improvement, but that does require basically a heads up to the city council, as I understand it.
Yes, sir.
It's an informational report. Does anybody have any questions about the report? Thank you. The last report is interdepartmental transfer of funds requests. Again, informational questions of staff. Seeing none, we'll move to general comments. I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wants to speak about anything.
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Rangeline. I merely wanted to mention something that took place earlier when it was agreed upon to go forward with the vote for the trash bins. We all forgot the most important matter. It may be called work comp, but it's also called low skill employment in the city of Columbia. We don't know how bad we need jobs, and here was an example that we're putting up before the voters. If they fail, we lose a lot of jobs, and this was a battle I had in my factory years. Machines can replace man, and then man doesn't have a job. We have to remember where that comes into play for future employment benefits. This other is involving the same subject. The individual says within the last few weeks we had a major fall out here at the area we call Old Hawthorne. Do we know, are we in the city when we speak of Old Hawthorne?
Yes.
Okay. This individual did take a major fall. He may never walk again. The person doing the talking has also fallen. Many times I've asked for the big construction to start slowing down, get these people online with people that believe in green energy, less utilities, not big houses, don't get you very far in this old world. What is the cost to have people on your rooftop shingling, doing their job, and then accidentally falling? We never think about the accident rate of anything that we're looking at in our future. Building smaller homes, I personally know a man who fell off a home over in Centralia, and he still lives disabled here in the city of Columbia. That was his job. We don't need more of the disabled on the list. As I stand before you as a disabled individual, anything that can be done in the future to let people be employed without the danger issue, please consider it. Thank you.
Greg Ahrens, 1504 Sylvan Lane. I just wanted to report that recently I've been not able to make it to the city council. I was trying to watch on online, which I had usually used to do, and have not been able to find, have not been able to get the signal to come in on my computer, and I'm not sure what the exact problem is. It's possible because they use this thing called Microsoft Silverlight. When I try it, it tells me that I need to install Silverlight, which I have already installed. And then when I try to install it, it says you already have it installed. So I'm still, I'm not sure what the problem is, except that I went, made the jump to Windows 10, and I think Silverlight's not compatible with Windows 10. So somehow or other, and I was able to watch the review, or, you know, to review a previous city council meeting, or the next day watch you know, instant replay or whatever you call it, but I'm not being able to get the live deal, and I was wondering if maybe there's something you guys could do at your end, or if it's something that has to be done through Microsoft or whatever. And also wondering if you could broadcast the, you know, because not everybody has cable, but if you could stream the city council meetings on something like Ustream or Livestream or YouTube, one of these services that are now out. The other point, I think I brought it up a few years ago, but it's still a problem. The Broadway Bridge over the East Broadway over to Hinkson Creek at Stevens Lake Park, when they built it, they only put fences along the sidewalks over the actual bridge. But the bridge approaches, and all four approaches, basically east side, west, east and west ends on north and south side, there's steep drop-offs where a person in a wheelchair or just a person on a bicycle or just walking could fall off the side of a cliff. I mean, well, it's not a cliff, but it's a steep drop-off. So anyway, I put this on the, what do you call it, report a problem on the city website just recently. So I'm hoping that at some point, maybe in my lifetime, that they'll put some fences up along the approaches as well as actually on the bridge. And I guess that's it for now. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Ahrens, let me say this, that pitchers and catchers report in mid-February.
Right. Yes. 109 days until
right.
Spring.
It'll be okay for both you and me.
We'll survive.
Right.
Thank you.
There's always next year, right?
Anyone else? We'll move to council comments. Down there anywhere?
Yeah, I got a couple of things. Angela has sat through the rest of the meeting after her presentation about the total solar eclipse coming up in a couple of years' time. And it does seem to me that we should at least explore the likely impact of that. Obviously, it has, you know, law enforcement, traffic, and tourism implications. So my thought would be ask the Convention and Visitors Bureau to maybe meet with Angela, and since this does seem likely to result in a lot of people wanting to come in at the same time, and then make some recommendations to council as to whether we should set up a task force or engage the police.
Happy to report that has already occurred.
Oh, it is.
And CVB's on top of it, and I think the goal tonight was to make sure everybody knew about it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So well, great. Well, good for you. Okay. So that was my first thing. I've got one other comment. We all received a letter from the Youth Advisory Council responding to, well, I mean, I don't know if you wanted to talk about this,
no,
Laura.
Go ahead.
But your presentation to them in August about alternatives to arrest and in the sort of juvenile justice system, and they recommend essentially the Wake Up campaign, which is an implicit bias education campaign, as well as peer courts within the schools, which I think the school district already does, encouraging counselors to understand the home backgrounds of children that are getting into trouble. And I just thought it was a very, very good professional report. I think this is the first thing that we've received from them. And as we discussed at a previous meeting, two of the Youth Advisory Council members are going to be at the National League of Cities conference this week in Nashville, and sharing their experiences here, as well as learning from other youth and other councils across the country. That's all I had.
Yeah, I just had one issue, one item, and that's to reinforce what Mr. Thomas said. We, some of us are leaving for the National League of Cities in Nashville starting on Wednesday, I believe. National League of Cities University starts some of their seminars. The city manager, I understand, is going to join us for the Digital Cities Award that Columbia has won. I think it's Thursday night or Friday night. One of the Thursday night, I think.
That's
it is.
Right.
And I believe you're attending, I'm attending, and I believe Mr. Ruffin is attending the meeting too. In addition to the, these are phenomenal meetings, and it's really the way to interconnect with some other cities to find out the solutions and some of the things that didn't work from some of these other cities. And as I understand it, Vice President Biden is going to be the keynote speaker for this thing as well. And not that I want to toot my own horn, but I'm supposed to go to an awards luncheon and get a Diamond Certification Award as well on Thursday afternoon. So we'll be back on Saturday, probably, next Saturday. But if there's anybody out there who has any questions, I will have my computer. I will be doing email. I will not have a cell phone, so I won't answer the phone when I'm there. I'll be busy with work there. But if anybody has any questions that are relevant to that or anything else, just let me know. Send me an email, and maybe I can get some of those questions answered if you have anything to ask some of the folks who might be able to answer those questions.
I'll pass.
A couple things. I'm only sorry I didn't buy up a big block of hotel rooms. The first time I heard Angela's presentation, I'm pretty excited.
There's Airbnb.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about the eclipse. So I'm glad that we're getting on top of it. I think it's going to be a phenomenon. I had a request from Carrie Gardner in regards to the Business Loop CID moving forward with being able to hang banners. That would be a big help for Mizzou North and the Museum of Art and Architecture. It's not officially in the second ward, but it's our front door. So until we annex it into the second ward, I'd still gonna speak out for the Business Loop. But if I would request that staff
I believe that there's actions that Water and Light needs to do, and Kerry Gardner is going to follow up with Water and Light in regards to that. And I also believe there's an ordinance process. So just to move that along, if we could draft an ordinance to move forward on the banners for the loop, as they're calling it now. And tomorrow there is an election. So I would humbly ask folks to please get out there and vote to support our wonderful parks. It's the only way that we're going to be able to add significant new green space. Single most important investment that a growing city can make, and the residents and surrounding areas of the future will be very grateful that we had the forethought to adequately fund green space preservation. Sports Field House is going to help. There's projects spread all over the city in a really fair and comprehensive way, all according to a master plan that has lots of public participation. And so please get out there and vote.
Amen.